All right, thank you, everybody. I think we're going to get started. Okay. So the meeting of the Joint Healthcare Human Services Finance Division and Healthcare and Human Services Policy and Oversight Committee will come to order, and we will get right to, thank you, Commissioner Ludeman, for coming down. We'll start right up. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Plural Chairman. Thank you, Chairman Putin and Chairman Huntley. Appreciate it. I'm Cal Ludeman, Commissioner of Human Services, and to the members as well. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss the General Assistance Medical Care today. General Assistance Medical Care, or GMC, is a state-funded program for low-income adults from 21 to 64 who have no dependent children and who do not qualify for federally funded health care programs. It provides comprehensive coverage to adults with incomes at or below 75% of the federal poverty guidelines and who have less than $1,000 in assets. Most enrollees get services through a health plan, and many GMC enrollees also receive general assistance. General Assistance Medical Care also has a hospitalization-only coverage plan. This pays for a single hospital stay for adults with income at or below 175% of poverty and assets of $10,000 for one person and $20,000 for a family of two. As everyone in this room is aware, funding for the GMC program was line item vetoed during the 2009 session, and an additional $15 million was unallotted from the program this summer. On November 6th, I announced plans to transition most GMC enrollees to transitional Minnesota care at the point that GMC coverage ends. DHS has a long-standing policy and practice of proactively determining eligibility for any program for which a person might be eligible. As communicated earlier, almost all GMC enrollees are eligible for Minnesota care, although the department certainly expects legislative action around the GMC issue. The department, as the administrator of this safety net program, also needed an implementation plan. Our goal is to transition GMC clients as seamlessly as possible to other health care coverage available under current law. The administrative costs associated with this implementation plan are similar to other administrative expenditures associated with administering Minnesota health care programs as they exist under current law. This current law authority, including the authority in ongoing systems budget riders, authorizes the department to continue health care coverage to GMC clients and to make this transition as seamless as possible. The transitional Minnesota care route offers the greatest continuity of coverage and the least administrative disruption for this vulnerable population. We are committed to partnering with counties, providers, county agencies, and faith-based organizations to help enrollees transition to Minnesota care coverage and remain enrolled in the program. We are holding the first of several forums this week for interested community stakeholders on how they can help enrollees through this transition. When GMC funding ends, all GMC enrollees, including those with qualifiers, will automatically move to transitional Minnesota care. Starting March 1st, people determined eligible for GMC will receive the transitional Minnesota care benefit set upon enrollment in a managed care plan. As of March 1st, there will be no hospitalization-only coverage plan. Counties will be required to pay premiums for all GMC clients enrolled in transitional Minnesota care for up to 6 months from the date of initial application. On average, the premium will be $5 a month for 3 to 4 months per client. Counties may choose to pay Minnesota care premiums beyond the transitional Minnesota care period. Counties would need to perform their own cost-benefit analysis on the value of continued payment of Minnesota care premiums. Currently, there are counties that continue to pay the Minnesota care premium beyond the 6 month period of time in order to reduce their administrative burden and to provide continuity of care for these individuals. The majority of Minnesota care enrollees receive coverage through a health plan. People who are covered through a health plan on GMC will remain in that plan for their Minnesota care coverage. To ensure continuous coverage for enrollees transitioning from GMC fee-for-service DHS will automatically enroll them in a Minnesota Care Health Plan until they can select a plan of their choice. Approximately 28,000 people on GMC with qualifiers are expected to be automatically enrolled in Minnesota Care March 1st when GMC coverage ends. The question of why coverage ends March 1st has been raised. This is the date we project that GMC eligibility will need to be terminated to keep spending within the limits of the GMC appropriation for fiscal year 2010. All obligations for the biennium must be paid out in the 2010 out of the 2010 appropriation. Based on the November 9th, 2009 forecast, the current 2010 appropriation is approximately $8 million short of the amount needed to fund GMC coverage for an additional month, that being the month of March in 2010. At the time of the veto, DHS and MMB informed the legislature there would be a substantial enrollment and cost shift between programs. The DHS fiscal note on the governor's veto anticipated a substantial shift of GMC clients to Minnesota Care. In the fiscal note, it was a general assumption that DHS, counties, and other institutions would do what they could to assist people who have been determined eligible for GMC to move to Minnesota Care and retain coverage. The November 2009 forecast anticipates a somewhat larger shift. The department realizes and recognizes the impact of these actions on the Health Care Access Fund. After the legislative session, if there are no amendments to current law, the department would review any legislative changes that may affect the Health Care Access Fund and consider additional actions available to it under Minnesota Statute Section 256L.02, Subdivision 3. But as you know, that statutory provision is currently a blunt instrument. It requires all or none disenrollment actions and does not provide any discretion to make income-based disenrollment decisions. I want to assure you that DHS will continue to provide technical assistance to stakeholders, counties, provider groups, and the general public. We have received a number of these requests and will continue to respond to these within our available resources. As this committee is aware, we are and will continue to provide the legislature with a monthly expenditure and enrollment report. I am compelled to make it clear, however, that the implementation of any GMC alternative proposal may or will take time. Resources are dedicated at this time to implementing the veto under current law. DHS will need to make substantial policy, payment, or systems modifications to implement a new program. These changes could only begin after a program modifications actually become law. Transitioning GMC clients to Minnesota Care is the most beneficial option available under current law to continue providing health care coverage to this population. DHS is committed to doing that in the most seamless way possible. Thank you, Chairman, and I would be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Huntley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Ludeman, how much expense is there in your department to move to the auto enrollment that the governor has proposed?
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner Ludeman,
you're talking about administrative expense on the
yes, administrative expense, number of employees, all that stuff.
Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind, I'm going to have to ask for a couple more resources. Billy Joe Zielinski, Assistant Commissioner for Minnesota Care or for Healthcare Operations, and Stephanie Radke, who is the Director of Minnesota Care Operations.
Welcome to
the
committee.
Will decide for themselves who can more appropriately answer some of those questions. This is Stephanie Wright.
And you got the question?
How many administrative resources are being spent on the...
And if you could just identify yourself as well, I'm sorry.
Stephanie Wright with the Department of Human Services. We have a implementation planning team dedicated to this effort. There are approximately, and I don't have the list of names in front of me, but there are approximately 15 people working on this implementation planning, and the system's costs are between $70,000 and $80,000 is our current estimate for the auto enrollment system's cost.
Representative Holly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner or the staff people. The forecast that just came out shows only about 11,000 people moving from GAMC to Minnesota Care. And typically we have 35,000 people at any given time on Minnesota Care. Well, what happens to the other people? Where do they go? All right.
I'm going to ask MMB, Kristen Dibdahl, to help me real quick.
Thank you. And if you would just state your name for the record.
For the record, I'm Kristen Dibdahl with Minnesota Management and Budget. I'm not familiar with the 11,000 figure. My understanding is that for the four-month period that remains in fiscal year 10, the figure is closer to 21,000.
I think one of the questions is after the 6 months, who's going to be renewing on Minnesota Care? I think that is where the 11,000 figure comes from. And so folks are going to be transitioned automatically, so they'll be on. But after that, after their period of time kind of auto-enrolling comes on, I think you're left with about 11,000 people actually continuing on Minnesota Care. And so there's going to be about 20,000-some people who won't re-enroll in Minnesota Care. And I guess Representative Huntley's question is, what happens to those folks?
Mr. Chair, my understanding would be that those folks would not have any health care coverage and that they would be receiving health care coverage through hospital care, et cetera, on an uncompensated care basis. The 20,000 individuals that will be auto-enrolled, 25% of them are expected to transition to regular Minnesota Care, and then after that, 67% of that remaining cohort would be in Minnesota Care, would renew for the first 12 months, and then 41% of that cohort would be remain in Minnesota Care in the second 12-month period.
Ms. Chairman, those percentages are that calculation. I think I can give some enlightenment to the 11,000 number. The 11,000 would be those who are currently enrolled in transitional Minnesota Care. There's an additional 21,000 that would be those who are not in transitional Minnesota Care but in GAMC only that would be transitioned then to Minnesota Care.
Okay, and then the projection off
but
of that
projections have the cascading effect of
that two-thirds of those folks would renew for another 12 months. Mm-hmm. And then of that group, 40% of that two-thirds would enroll for the next two-year period.
Correct.
Okay. All right, thank you.
And Mr. Chair and Commissioner, when does the Healthcare Access Fund go into deficit? Assuming that you do not transfer any money from the general fund into the Healthcare Access Fund.
That would be July of 2011, Mr. Chairman. Well, no, that would be good. So that would be July 1st of 2001.
Without
no trans,
why then do you have in your budget a net of about $160,000 going from the general fund to the healthcare access fund? There's the about $60 million, I believe, that the healthcare access fund is supposed to put into the general fund, and then there is also about $100 million transfer from the healthcare from the general fund into the healthcare access.
Chairman, let me be more clear about that. Before fiscal year, by the time of July 1st, fiscal year 12 begins, there would be $48 million not transferred from the healthcare access fund to the general fund, and an additional $111 million. Spent from the general fund into the healthcare access fund to have it establish a zero balance by July 1st of 2012.
And when would the fund go into deficit if those transfers did not occur?
Mr. Chair, that would occur in fiscal year 11.
During fiscal year 11?
Correct.
Sometime. And is the transfer from the general fund to the healthcare access fund, why is that there? My understanding is that whatever is in language terminates on July 1 of 2011.
Well, Mr. Chair, there is transfer language that says that if there is a shortfall in meeting Minnesota Care obligations, that the general fund must make a transfer to meet those obligations. And that is in effect until fiscal year 11. After fiscal year 11, the statute no longer applies.
So, Mr. Chairman, that would be true for only this biennium, not any following.
Oh, then what you're saying is that when fiscal year 11 is over, the healthcare access fund will be, under current law,
yes,
will be in deficit.
Yes, it would.
And just my own personal comment, and that's because you're moving a group of people into the healthcare access fund who cannot work because of their health condition. And Minnesota Care was intended to be for working people in the state that don't get health insurance where they work. So we're going to be moving people in and eventually kicking out working people out of health care. That's a statement, not a comment, but you can answer it.
Mr. Chair, I won't answer that, but I would provide some additional information. If we took out the impact of the line item veto, the healthcare access fund would have approximately a $220 million deficit at the end of fiscal year 13.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm not quite sure who to address this to, but I appreciate the problem-solving thinking that's going on in the room, and I'm glad actually to see so many people actually agree that there's a problem that we have to solve, so that's a good thing. I was looking at this DHS fact sheet here, and I just looked at the second section. Here's what you need to know about the change, and the second item says, you will get a letter in the mail telling you when you need to renew your coverage. And as I talked to some mental health advocates and chemical dependency folks, they just said there's a lot of people in GMC who have no fixed address, so that we can't mail them anything. And I don't know if you know what percentage of people might be in that category where we can't find them so that they can enroll or re-enroll.
Becky.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not have the numbers yet of how many are homeless, but recognize the issue. And so to that end, we are partnering with external community stakeholders and how they can help some of these populations, some of these people, with complying with the renewal requirements, understanding that they may have difficulty in receiving the paperwork and returning it appropriately.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, by stakeholders, we have, first of all, many folks are under many of them are under a managed care organization contract where the managed care organization themselves are on the ground in the streets talking to people who are currently GMC populations, not every day, but an outreach program. The clinics themselves have access to this information. That's part of the stakeholder group that we will be talking to. Many nonprofits and faith-based communities are in contact as much as they possibly can be. But the rest of the projection about the homeless nature of it would be anecdotal at best, but I've heard it's percentages as high as 20%.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if any of the folks who are testifying could enlighten us when we get to public testimony, but that would be helpful.
Okay. Representative Murphy, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had in our work to try and understand the population, had asked some questions specifically about the population, and did sort of get a month-by-month breakdown of who's in which category. So this, for the month of June of 2009, there were 9,375 people who were homeless in DAMC. So that's just 1 month snapshot, but I think it's a helpful number.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Ludeman, first of all, to the earlier comments with regard to the 11,000 folks, help me out here, that everybody that's on GAMC is going to be transferred to Minnesota Care, isn't that correct?
That's correct.
And as that transfer occurs, these folks will be re-enrolling in GAMC, in Minnesota Care, excuse me. Is there anybody within that group who's not allowed to re-enroll in Minnesota Care?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, there would be a few instances where for availability of other insurance coverage, if they are on the short, what I would call the short end of transitional care, Minnesota Care may not have enough time enrolled in that to actually achieve the qualifications for the four-month barrier for that availability of other insurance. But generally speaking, it can be said categorically that almost all of the current GMC population would be eligible for Minnesota Care. 11,000 were already in this space called transitional Minnesota Care today.
I just wanted to clear that up because I think the inference was that there was 11,000 that would transfer and 20-some thousand that would be somehow ineligible, and I think that that was needed to be corrected. Secondly, just looking at the population as it moves from General Assistance Medical Care to Minnesota Care, if we were to currently, right now, if the Healthcare Access Fund goes into deficit, we automatically begin to disenroll Minnesota Care by single adults. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that is true starting in the next biennium, not this biennium. In this biennium, the first thing that happens is stop the transfer of the Healthcare Access Fund to the General Fund. And for this biennium, that means till July 1st of 2011, the General Fund will pay the Healthcare Access Fund whatever it takes. But after that, then the automatic disenrollment by statute would have to take place.
And Mr. Chair and Commissioner Ludeman, if the legislature acted in the 2010 session to change the disenrollment procedures within Minnesota Care, couldn't that be enacted before the disenrollment were to take place?
Mr. Chairman, certainly. That would be almost 18 months ahead of time if it did, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's helpful. And one other question, as long as you're here. We're going to be hearing about the proposal that was put forward by the Democrat caucus on last Thursday. And one of the questions that I had about that deals with the surcharge that is being proposed, that we increase the surcharge that we currently have. And I've been doing a little bit of reading about that over the weekend, and one of the things that I've come across is that there's a federal cap at approximately 5%, that states are kind of doing this. They're marking up their bills to the federal government so we get more money back, and I understand how that works. We do it currently, and a lot of other states do it. Could you talk a little bit about what that federal cap is? Is it in statute, and where are we right now with regard to that cap?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dean, we have only begun to analyze the proposal. We met with members of the legislature and staff, with my staff as well, as early as Friday. The cap is a CMS cap. I mean, it's the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services puts a 5.5% cap on the taxing power of Medicaid expenditures, for example, so that whatever federal, this is to keep other states from massively taxing their system so that they can capture even more federal funds than other states, for example. So living within that cap has been pretty much the lifeblood of CMS policy for quite some time. We are I can't think of where we are. Three point six something is where we are against that cap right now. But I would like to defer, if I could, about the technicalities of the MA surcharge until we know exactly how much that would potentially raise or how that actually works. But basically, it's a taxing power that a state would use against health care expenditures in some area. In this case, mostly it's talking about in the hospital inpatients. The state then pays a higher Medicaid rate, and as that rate is paid, the federal share is matched at approximately 50, or if it's eligible for enhanced FMAP, it would be 62% currently, and that is where the federal money would be able to be captured, so to speak.
Mr. Chair, last question. And does the 2% provider tax that we currently have, that's within the 3.67?
Mr. Chairman, that's true, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Oh. You know, I'd be so soon. I was talking to my county about this thing, and I think we've got our work cut out for us between now and the end of whatever day we get out of here in May. And I think this is but one of the challenges we're going to have to face. And I just in short, I hope we look at the human service pot as a global thing. And, I'm interested in this important topic as well, but I think we need to remember the forest too. And to those in the audience and watching, we're short $1.2 billion and then $5 billion some, and you know, some people are suggesting we cut some very sensitive areas, and so this is just the first of many very difficult meetings and talks. I talked to my county about their Minnesota Care experience. A few years ago, we had a time where Anoka County had 2,100 people on Minnesota Care, on GAMC, and then Transitional Minnesota Care came along, and they were able to enroll 1,200 of those people into that program. And those people spent $10 million at hospitals, and only $670,000, that was above the 10%, the $10,000 per person thing, which was at least a little reassuring to me that that people won't be, that there was, at least on, that's the Anoka County population. I have no idea what Hennepin and the rest of them are, but that's just my county that I talked to a couple of days ago, which puts us in the range of 7%, which is, yes, a number that's not a number you like, but it's a manageable number, and I don't know what regions would be. I'd be interested to see what they do with their cap. And so there's some 900 people yet in my county on GAMC that blink in and out. But it just occurred to me when I was talking to my social service director that I've not heard a word from any of the 1,200 people that are in the Minnesota Care part about problems they've had accessing care. And so just to, at least there's something in place, and the people aren't going to be on the street, and there's a mechanism that exists. And so we can improve upon that if we all agree, if the governor agrees, and as the dialogue goes on. So I'm here to be part of the solution about that. But I thought you'd be kind of interested that that's in existence now. And one other thing I just want to mention, I wasn't a fan of the veto, just, you know, it wasn't my advice. But the what the Minnesota Care switchover does do, pushes people to clinics. And that's actually something that we like. We've talked about getting people out of the ER into the clinics, and in the current structure we have, there's no cap on clinic care in Minnesota Care. So that's just some observations, and I guess it's not a question. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to go back to this issue about how many people would be transitioning and so on, because as I understand the way GAMC works, this isn't a program where people think about it ahead of time and they go, gee, I don't have any insurance and I'm probably eligible for GAMC, so let me go sign up, right? This is a program where people show up at an emergency room, they're poor, they're sick, they need care, and then the hospital often will be how they get enrolled onto GAMC. So is that, if you could just nod your head, Commissioner, okay, that's accurate then. So I assume from that there are many people in our state who actually could be on GAMC, who are eligible for GAMC, who in fact are not on the program because they just haven't yet showed up at the emergency room needing to be covered. So when we go back to what the proposal is here, what the governor, what your department is planning to do here, and we're talking about how many people would be transitioning to Minnesota Care, as I'm understanding it, you're only talking about people who are actually on the program, actually enrolled on March 1st. And anybody who gets sick on March 2nd and would normally go into the GAMC program because they come into the hospital with some problem and they don't have funds and they would be eligible, those people are not covered under your plan. Is that right?
Commissioner.
That is correct. I think this offers an opportunity, though, to talk about GAMC as an enrollment and a coverage program. No other state tries to attempt to have an actual coverage program like this. They would first support the infrastructure for providing health care for this population. In many states, it's called indigent care. Some states have uncompensated care pools. But this is against the backdrop of knowing that there are 400,000 Minnesotans who have no insurance at any given day. This happens to be one of the poorest populations of that 400,000 Minnesotans who have no insurance. So the difference between someone that makes 76% of federal poverty guidelines would be facing the exact same problems as someone, more of a problem than someone that was making 74% of federal poverty guidelines. I'm not going to try to slice this to make that any kind of a struggle in that regard, but trying to do this in a coverage environment has been much of a difficulty because it relates to waiting till a person who has not only they as an individual, but a nonprofit or a faith-based community or a county has not been able to identify them, find them, and pre-enroll them as what we would consider insurance environment. So this is a very difficult, what we do, the state does, is say very vulnerable to whoever walks in this door for whatever comprehensive health care is provided to any set of individuals that qualify for GAMC. So it is the administration of it is more difficult because we don't actually administer it. We just pay the claims, whether it be in fee-for-service or in a capitated rate to our managed care organization. And that's kind of how GAMC currently works.
Ms. Radke, because we've had conflicting information on your question, and I think actually my understanding is a little different with the people that aren't enrolled as of March 1st. So, Ms. Radke.
Mr. Chair, Representative, after March 1st, for new applicants coming to county offices, the plan is to still use the transitional Minnesota care route for those people as well. So they would continue to apply at their county offices. They determined eligible for the program most advantageous for them, for which they are eligible, hopefully MA, if they can get a certification of disability, would have eligibility continue to be determined for GAMC. And if determined eligible for GAMC, they would continue to go down the transitional Minnesota care route and get enrolled in a managed care plan and have coverage start upon enrollment in that plan.
So just to clarify, the department still plans to enroll people in GAMC, but move them along more quickly to transitional Minnesota care, even though there's no money in GAMC. So for that time that before they get enrolled in transitional Minnesota care, there would be essentially no coverage.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank
it's
you.
Yeah,
confusing. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is confusing. And Commissioner, you know, I appreciate your expounding a little bit on the larger problem here, and you know, and we probably agree on a lot of what the problem is. But I just want my real point here was, you know, let's not pretend that, you know, because we're transitioning this small slice of people to Minnesota care, that we're solving the problem, because the sick people are still going to show up at the emergency room, and I'm really still not clear about what happens then to the person on March 2nd who shows up. And, you know, is that just uncompensated care from the point of view of the hospital? Is that what we're looking at? And then from that point on, because these are not the people that are going to show up at the county office and say, gee, I need coverage, what am I eligible for? They're not going to think about it. Well, they may think about it, but they're not going to, probably many of them are not going to do much about it until the need is really there. So, you know, right? Is that what we're talking about?
Chairman, Representative, yeah, that basically is this. There's no retroactive payment feature for an episode of care immediately before successful enrollment in Minnesota care. That is correct.
Thank you.
And
it,
you've also identified, we are very transparent about this. This is not just 28 or 30 or 32,000 people in JMC any given year. There's a considerable higher number that move in and out of JMC during that period of time, more than twice that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think actually that's a good segue into what I was thinking about. You know, we're here talking about one program here today, and this is so, this picture is just so much bigger than one program or one group of acronym. And as we think about how we actually serve people versus retain a program, it seems to me that that's the important part of what we ought to be discussing is really about how we serve people. And I actually want to thank you, Commissioner, for bringing forward a proposal from the Governor's office that is about actually making sure that we're serving people and creating a soft landing for a difficult situation as opposed to just saying hands up. So I give you a lot of credit for doing that. One of the things as we get into this discussion, though, I think that's important to note, and I think we've kind of touched it a little bit here and there, is that with the Health Care Access Fund, it's not necessarily if it goes broke, but when it goes broke. So we're talking about a set of time frames, not whether. And then, Commissioner, I guess I'll make a comment and then end with a question. It's also not a matter of whether we serve people, but how we serve people. And so, Commissioner, I guess the question I have for you is, even before the veto occurred, the Governor's office and your department saw a distinct need for reform within this system called GAMC in the first place. You had some reform ideas. You had some ideas for how we might change it even before some of the vetoes occurred. Do you still see that there's a need to reform the system in general, no matter what we come up with today in this hearing related to this one program? It's a bigger picture, and you guys had some, I thought, pretty good ideas related to how we serve people in a way that's more sustainable, in a way that's more cost-effective for the taxpayers, but also serve those folks most in need.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I will answer that, but this isn't the context of this. That was then, and this is now. The budget has been reconciled, and now it's out of balance once more, and so we're into a $1.2 billion shortfall environment now. So some of these discussions are different than they were then. With that said, I'll tie into a little what Representative Abler said a little bit. What we think is more important is that we drive patients and insured and covered individuals into a clinic environment more than a hospital. Obviously, that's the first goal. Easier said than done when someone does not help and does not think about that, and I understand all the circumstances why that may be. But our previous proposal was to spend $70 million to provide coverage for GMC people in this clinic environment, including a care coordination fee for those clinics to be able to better coordinate the care so that you could have a second or a third or a fourth encounter with these covered individuals so that they could get back on a health trail and achieve a higher health status than simply waiting for a hospitalization. This is not just a problem with GMC. This is also a problem with Minnesota Care and commercial populations and state legislators and commissioners alike, that we don't spend enough time and attention on those kind of care issues alike. It also talked about a $100 million contribution for an uncompensated care pool that was going to try to deal proportionally with this hospital issue that will continue to be talked about quite a bit. This veto will have its major effect on hospitals, especially those hospitals that see most of the GMC population for these high-cost episodes of care. And even the Minnesota Care solution will be capped at $10,000. I think most of you understand the difference between the benefit sets. But driving more health care back toward the clinic level is obviously the reform. That's what when we say health care homes or medical homes in this state, that's what we're trying to accomplish so that we can get more attention at the appropriate level. Ultimately, then also for the right price or right cost. But that is it is hard to reform a program now when it has been vetoed. To talk about it in that way, but that was our proposal back in 2009.
President Brock.
One last comment. And I don't mean to be controversial, but I suppose I might. It seems to me it's interesting, this discussion that we're having. We're trying to figure out how to keep this group of people out of a program that we've been spending year after year trying to put people in, meaning Minnesota Care. And so it just is—it's interesting to me. As we walk through this difficult discussion and this difficult situation, we've got to look at things in a bigger picture than just programmatic. And so I appreciate the opportunity, and I appreciate the discussion, and I look forward to working with everybody trying to move this forward in a less programmatic and more individual-focused way.
Thank you. Well, I actually really appreciate those comments, because I think that's the direction that Representative Murphy and her proposal is actually heading. I don't recall exactly this GAMC healthcare home proposal that you put forward last year, unless you're talking more generally about healthcare homes and moving in reform in that direction. I remember the uncompensated care pool part of your proposal from last year. But I'm glad that we're all on the same page of wanting to move toward trying to coordinate care, and I think you'll see when Representative Murphy comes up that that's the case. And I absolutely agree that this should be done on a personal instead of programmatic basis. But just a couple of things. I mean, it is true that these are people, as Representative Liebling said, that are much more likely not to enroll, but just to show up at the hospital. And so as we deal with this population on a kind of personal level, one thing that we do have to keep in mind is that these folks, we want to make sure that we're protecting our hospitals. And so if this is a population that's just going to show up at the hospital, retroactive coverage, above all, is actually a very important piece of the GAMC program as opposed to Minnesota Care, kind of dealing with the individual unique circumstances of the individuals in this program. You'd agree with that, right?
Well, Mr. Chairman, certainly. But anything we can do to divert it actually from entrance into the emergency room is the key.
And we're all four square on that one, I think, as you'll see when Representative Murphy comes. But I think that we also have to acknowledge there are differences between these programs. And dealing on a personal instead of a programmatic basis, as Representative Broad would have us think, and I think appropriately so, this is a population where it actually does make sense, maybe more than a more typical Minnesota Care population, where we would want that retroactive coverage just to make sure that our hospitals have some financial stability. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Chairman, if hospital financial stability is the goal, I think on its face that is more probably proportionally what the expenditures of current GMC construction is than the actual coverage for clinic-level healthcare is proportionately, just so we recognize that on its face. If that is the goal, that certainly is accomplished by GMC and its current construction.
And you'd agree that that's one important goal.
It's an important goal.
Yes. Okay. Representative Norton had a question.
Just a quick one, and I really appreciate Representative Broad and Representative Tiefen's comments. That was some of what I wanted to talk about. As I'm looking through just the two handouts that you gave us, I would say some of the issues raised earlier with this population being difficult to reach, difficult to enroll in programs, continually enrolling in programs as particularly as our economy continues to be tough. I'm looking at some issues that seem to be kind of an instability. People get in a program, they're in for just a short period of time, they have to re-enroll. I see re-enrollment with this population as being perhaps very difficult. And I'm also very concerned about the copay, so I see a lot of administration, perhaps, needs with this transition Minnesota Care, with people going off and on. And the copays, if I'm looking at someone that's making under $8,000 a year, and I'm looking particularly at the $3 copay for each prescription drug, and knowing that many of these people that have health issues and also might have mental health issues, that could be a considerable amount of $3 prescription drugs that they might have each month, and if you've only got $8,000 a year to live on and you've got any other expenses, which we all certainly do, that could be a real issue. So what I'm getting to with all these concerns that I'm just seeing with certainly just where we are now or with this proposal is that we are going to see more uncompensated care. And you mentioned the pool that you had brought forward last year, and I guess the bottom line is no matter what we do, I mean, who's going to pay the uncompensated care that the hospitals have? I mean, I guess that would be my question, because ultimately, with the proposal and the gaps I see, it means increased uncompensated care, and somebody's going to pay for that.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, well, you know, unless other alternatives are found, and I know that the ACMC and others have changed some of their business model already, and in fact established a foundation to make, because hospitals will bear the cost of uncompensated care, as they currently, all hospitals do to some degree or another already. This is for these 30,000 people. There's 400,000 uninsured Minnesotans who some have an ability to pay and choose not to do so ahead of time, but many of them would also claim an inability to pay. The administratively, though, I don't think, you know, the turn in the GMC is in and of itself at the county level quite a burden as well. A GMC patient may show up in an emergency room, have a very expensive inpatient visit, and never visit GMC or a hospital in Minnesota again. And so administratively, we're actually paying a coverage cost for some period of time until they sort of get lost again, and then we wait till they're found again. But administratively, I don't know if Minnesota Care is harder to administer. I would say that actually the rules of Minnesota Care are easier to administer because it is a rule-based coverage plan with obviously a more limited benefit structure than GMC, which is very comprehensive and expensive. I would remind this legislature, too, that the cost in the current construction of GMC in the next biennium would be just a few thousand dollars short of $1 billion in the next biennium, because it was growing at a rate of 36% per biennium for the last two bienniums. So it was getting very expensive, and much of that in these in that hospital sector extraordinary high-cost episodes, which we all understand. I mean, heart conditions and diabetes, results of diabetic conditions can get extremely expensive. Mental health conditions, as you well know, a large number of these folks have either a chemical dependency or a mental health condition that needs the appropriate kind of health care that can be very expensive. I think I answered two or three questions of what you asked, only one, Representative North. I'm sorry.
Representative Hulley.
Well, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Ludeman, if it's $1 billion the next biennium and we get rid of GAMC, they will still have $1 billion spent on them. The question is who pays for it, and what we will see is our premiums go up, because you and I will pay for that uncompensated care cost. Commissioner, I just wanted to say, and I want the people listening to know that he's been very open with us and has come in and with a, I think half of the Department of Human Services last Friday to discuss.
Mr. Chairman, that wasn't half.
And you know, they've been very open, and I do think they're looking for a solution to this problem. The commission certainly understands that. The GAMC population is not the population of working people that are amenable to insurance regulations. I mean, what's going to happen, I can tell you, is that somebody will show up in a hospital, he'll get admitted to Minnesota Care, and the question is, would we pay for the first day's treatment or the second day? And then they're going to go away and drop off, and then they're going to show up at the hospital again, and if it's within 4 months, we're going to say, well, you're not eligible because Minnesota Care says you got to be without insurance for 4 months. So we're dealing with two different populations. One that's a typical working class, people that just don't get it, and they're amenable to regular insurance regulations. Most of the people on GAMC, I don't think, are amenable to the insurance model. The commissioner and I certainly agree the best thing we could do is get these people primary care and keep them out of the hospital if we can figure out a way to do that.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you.
And I think then we're going to, after your question, we're going to move on. But
thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I more want to make a comment. And thank you, Representative Hunt, because it really leads into what I wanted to say. And, you know, a couple of years ago, a bunch of counties in southeast Minnesota worked really hard together to put together a steadfast managed care plan, essentially. And we got it all the way through the legislature, and a lot of the enrollees to this would have been the very same people we're talking about here. And, you know, I'm glad everybody's so interested in providing, but I think we all agree we need to provide care before people get to the point where they need expensive in-hospital care, and that's what this would have done. And, of course, the governor decided to veto that plan, and there's a great irony in that, that we're here today talking about this and talking about making counties pay for the premiums to put these same people on Minnesota care. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, thank you, Commissioner, and I want to reiterate what Representative Huntley, I think everybody working on this proposal, and not just the proposal that Representative Murphy is bringing forward, but all the proposals are in a problem-solving mode, want to fix this, and I know that the department is interested in the solution as well. And so I hope that we can keep moving forward in that spirit, because we can't wait till May. We need to move in February, and that's what our goal is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Murphy. And members, I think you have a copy of the draft proposal, SC7048-6, in your packets. Is there an amendment, too?
Yes, Mr.
Of
sorts?
Okay. Do we... It's in the packet. We don't have to incorporate or anything. We'll just discuss it. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Houston Huntley, and really thank you to members of the committees for taking time out in December.
And
I'm Representative Aaron Murphy.
And can I just for kind of planning purposes, I think we're going to try to go maybe 20 to 25 minutes on this and Representative Dean, and then we'll go to the testimony just so we can get everybody through. Or shorter if you want.
I will skip on through. Anyhow, it's December, and I appreciate people being here today, both committee members and those in the audience, to continue in that spirit of problem solving on the issue of general assistance medical care. I'm going to begin today by just walking briefly through the proposal that the House and Senate have put together, and this is definitely a work in progress. I'm glad that we have something concrete to bring to the table, along with a number of other organizations that have been working over the summer and the fall, and they're going to be presenting proposals today. I think that we're at that point in time where we need to begin to look at concrete proposals and language so that we can actually have something ready to go at the beginning of session. And that is what this is. We will continue to work with members of the committee and members of the legislature and the administration to improve this to a place where people can agree and get something signed into law. The proposal offers continuous, ongoing access to basic medical services for the vulnerable populations currently served by general assistance medical care. It's a temporary program that will last until June 30th of 2011, the end of the biennium. It is of lower cost, and it offers reform, recognizing the vulnerable status of this population. And we've done a fair amount of looking at who is served by DAMC, and there are multiple populations inside DAMC, but one of their hallmarks is they're largely sick, and they are poor, often poor because they are sick. High rates of mental illness, persistent mental illness, high rates of chemical dependency, and other chronic physical conditions that do create a barrier to their ability to work. This proposal would protect vital jobs in Minnesota's healthcare sector, which I think is important in the period of recession that we are experiencing. And it restores the solvency of the Healthcare Access Fund through 2012 with no general fund transfer required, which is helpful in our efforts to try and solve the budget deficit. The legislative proposal is funded without new taxes. It does rely instead on financing mechanisms available to the legislature, and we did talk about this briefly. So we are maximizing existing state and federal health care funding streams. That's the hospital surcharge and medical assistance, the HMO surcharge, and federal disproportionate share hospital or DSH payments. We are eliminating eligibility categories for county inmates, those people that are incarcerated in county facilities, for sex offenders, for those with access to private insurance, and those getting their coverage through the hospital-only program, those people above 75% of federal poverty. We are working to maximize enrollment in other health care programs. For instance, pregnant women that are currently served in general assistance medical care would go to medical assistance, which is a more appropriate coverage mechanism for those people. And then also to try and move as quickly as we can people with disabilities into Medicaid or Social Security insurance. And we would be reducing reimbursement to all providers. So there is a significant payment reduction for providers in this proposal. The proposal offers reform. There's an innovative payment and delivery model also called, it's known as an accountable care organization in today's lexicon. We've also talked about it in Minnesota as a total cost of care, in which providers take on some financial risk in exchange for greater flexibility in caring for the vulnerable adults facing significant and complex health conditions, including homelessness, mental health diagnoses, and substance abuse. In an ACO, providers and others would work together to keep the population in their care as healthy as possible and out of the hospital, and we believe that will both provide two goals. One, a healthier population, and two, a savings to the system. It creates a mental health urgent care benefit to be paired with state-operated services in an effort to reduce mental health hospitalizations, and we know by looking at the population that there is a high population that has mental illness, persistent mental illness. Many are in the hospital too long waiting for a transfer to a more appropriate place for their care. We heard from Regents Hospital back in November that there was somebody that had been admitted in the hospital in September and was still hospitalized waiting for a more appropriate facility placement. And that is definitely contributing to the high cost of hospitalization care. I want to let you know that we met this morning with Dr. Reed Trulich from the Department of Human Services, and they have pledged their technical assistance or offer technical assistance, and I think that they may have some ideas on this proposal and how to improve it to make it work more satisfactorily for the population, and so I think we will see changes in this part of the proposal. We did not get to this point alone. I want to first thank my colleagues in the House, both the Democrats and Republicans, for the time people have taken to work on this and other proposals, and for the good faith effort to come together around a solution. I'd like to recognize the work of the administration to date. The staff at DHS have been working to provide technical assistance and feedback on this and other proposals, and I appreciate as well the open door of the governor's office as we continue to work on this proposal. In July, health policy members visited 9 safety net hospitals all over the state to hear about the need to continue providing basic health care benefits to this medically needy population. And since August, House and Senate members have held numerous meetings with hospitals, health plans, providers, unions, counties, representatives of the faith community, the safety net organizations, grassroots organizations, mental health advocates, and many others to discuss policy and financing alternatives to the DAMC program. And as Jeff Sparks said the other day, this is the continuation of the session that hasn't ended yet, and he's in the room. So I want to just attribute that comment to him. We've worked hard and long, lots of us have, on coming up with a solution. I'd like to acknowledge the various efforts of the stakeholders and advocates and their efforts to develop proposals for consideration today. And many of the ideas in this proposal come from the work by others over the fall. And I hope that helps us come together around one solution. I want to share that from my perspective, both as a legislator and as a nurse, that this is not a perfect solution and it does not fully restore the DAMC program as we know it today. The cuts are deep and the consequences of that are real. But I want to be clear that it's a starting point for a continued work to find a bipartisan solution, one that will protect the poorest Minnesotans, middle-class families who pay health insurance premiums, and the hospitals and other healthcare institutions over the next 16 months as we evaluate the temporary solution going forward, its impact on the budget in the next biennium, and further opportunities in reform and partnering. Minnesota is in a unique time. We are short on resources in Minnesota, but we're rich in content, and I can see that in this room. And I am convinced that we can fix this if we put our heads together. And I look forward to your input today and over the next 6 months as we prepare a solution for the start of the session. And with that, I'll take your questions. Thank you.
Questions, members? Representative Ainsley.
I have a lot of thoughts about this, but I'll just keep them to a minimum at this point. Could staff describe for us the mechanism of a surcharge, or somebody describe how that works with some detail? And I'm interested in how it works. And I'm also interested in, is there some group that's going to wind up paying a net increase? So if that would be staff or some other experts in the audience, so that
Mr. Chun
and Murphy has.
Mr. Chair, Rector Abler, the two surcharges here, and there's also a nursing home surcharge that isn't increased, were passed some years back, I think, during tight budget times, and they were a means of basically obtaining some federal match. And the way that usually these surcharges would work would be that the money would, say, go into the general fund. It would then could be, or you know, that money could be used as, say, the state share for a federal Medicaid match, or the state share of a Medicaid match, and then it would then obtain the federal match. And then what would often happen would be that there would be some increase in reimbursement to the particular group of healthcare providers. The federal law, you know, I think prohibits a one-to-one, you know, guaranteed home harmless. But, for example, you know, nursing home rates would be increased, or there's some language in here that would compensate hospitals in the aggregate for the surcharge that's paid. And the surcharges were used as a means, again, to draw down the federal match. And then I think, as the commissioner mentioned earlier, that did lead to some federal concerns. There were a number of states that, I guess, used the surcharge to a much greater degree than Minnesota has.
Representative, thank you. That's helpful history. Can you read us a specific question? I understand generally, I mean, a little bit about this, we get some federal match, which we use to pay for the program, pretty much, at least a good part of it. Is there, except for the fact the money comes from the feds, who are $1.4 trillion in debt, and is that money even sustainable, except all that aside, you know, and all the budgetary things that are going on there, if the money is sustainable, is there anybody, is there any, like, payer that's going to wind up paying more, or some of their self-insured, do they pay more on this? Is that going to hit them? Is any citizen going to pay a higher hospital fee that, do you know that? Because somebody said it was, but I don't know, and so can you enlighten me?
Mr. Chen?
Mr. Rector Abler, I guess I'm not sure how, you know, this money would be transferred. I think the intent would be that when the surcharge is levied, usually there was some type of compensating provider reimbursement increase, and I think the intent of that was to hold the provider group in the aggregate whole. So I think that in theory, you know, there would not have to be a reason why other rates would be increased. But, you know, I don't know the details of how all of this would actually work in hospitals.
And we do have Ms. Cranky and others from the hospital association who may be able to discuss this as well.
Okay, let me just offer two more things, and I'll be done with this part. My county called me in that same conversation, and the $29 million or so that would be assessed to the counties is going to be shared by Anoka County, which is about $1 million to them, as this would be, they'd be anticipating. And they were troubled by that, just, you know, as a money source, if 10% is going to come from the counties, which was, if they did pay 10% of GAMC back in the 80s, I guess, and they were relieved of that. And so they will have to probably lay off some people to do that, I think.
And Representative Murphy has...
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, the 10% county share is a return to former state policy, not one that I'm in love with, and I understand that it is a cause of concern for the counties. So to be clear, the counties would be asked to pay 10% of their JMC spend for the previous year. So it's not a 10% of the full cost, but by county, the 10% of what they had spent in GAMC in the previous year. So for some counties, it's small, and for other counties, it's more substantial, depending on the GAMC population they're caring for. I haven't gone into a lot of detail on the funding mechanisms and what they raise, because we've sent this over to the Department of Human Services, and we don't have figures. We have some estimates from our staff, estimates from the Senate staff, but until we get better numbers from the Department of Human Services on what these different mechanisms raise and what the proposal costs, I don't think that we can say with clarity which parts can stay and go, but I will tell you that the county share for part of the proposal is a part that I hope that we can address going forward.
And Resident Murphy, are you concerned at all, if there is not a proposal for some of these folks, many of whom have mental illness as an example, of where they might end up elsewhere in the county system? And there may be higher county costs if we don't do this, like in jails and corrections and things like that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I think the rationale for the county share and a payment from the counties is to offset and provide relief so that the counties don't have those unintended costs that come from the line item veto, and in particularly in corrections and public safety.
And the counties are also going to be testifying later today, too, so we can talk more about that. Representative Abler.
That's fine. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, can I talk just briefly about the amendment?
Yes.
So there have been, and that is the S048A1. There have been different proposals that have been brought forward by some of the different advocacy organizations and the hospitals in particular on how they might participate in the funding of this mechanism, and that would be, of course, by taking a cut. They have proposed what they have affectionately called a donut hole in the past, in which they would be paid for the first $10,000 of care provided by the hospital, and then they would be financially exposed for another $10,000, and then they would be responsible, or they would pay it again after that $10,000, so $20,000 and beyond, the state would be responsible for that. One proposal. A second proposal was this idea of creating a threshold of entry into payment based on the amount of DAMC business that you do. So the smaller hospitals would have a $500,000 threshold before they would be paid. Larger hospitals, $1 million threshold before they would be paid. And there was some concern about that proposal because some of the smaller hospitals that do provide care in DAMC might never make that $500,000 threshold. And so this amendment is language that's been drafted, I think, by the hospitals that creates a more uniform mechanism. I think it's probably easier to administer, but it really is just a ratable reduction for the hospitals, again, based on the amount of DAMC population you see. So there's a higher reimbursement rate for hospitals that do a large percentage of their business in DAMC, and a lower reimbursement rate for the hospitals that see a smaller percentage of DAMC in their hospitals, but all hospitals then would have access to payment. So that is one of the many changes that's happening with this proposal as we move forward, and I just wanted to make sure you understood that.
Representative Bond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, I'm going to ask a question I presented to some of the stakeholder groups a week and a half ago or so. So I'll just give you to give your general comments on this topic. Most of the various versions of proposals have to do with cutting payments to various groups or to determine kind of level of uncompensated care that might end up in the final form of the proposals. And unlike some of the other areas of the budget, when we've been looking for budget expenditure reductions, there really wasn't ever discussion that I could see of the benefits that available to GAMC clients. Now, it may well be this is because of the unique nature of these clients, because they're very complicated cases, they postpone care, and they show up with very severe things. But in many areas, whether it's our Minnesota Care clients or other folks on public programs on MA, we have adjusted the benefit sets as part of the approach to containing costs, not just cut payments or cut change eligibility. So if you could comment generally on where that fits in or doesn't fit into this discussion and why, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn. We did look at the issue of benefits as we looked at this proposal, and as we talked with a number of the providers in particular, and from our perspective, we were able to believe the proposal that we have with provider cuts and limited eligibility is going to yield more cost savings than we would if we cut benefits. And that as we talked with providers in particular, they didn't think, and I agree, that cutting benefits for this population was going to yield the cost savings that we needed to. And then I also want to draw your attention to the idea of an accountable care organization where a group of providers come together and instead of listing a set of benefits, they're going to provide the care within a certain cost constraint. And so then in that model, benefits, that list of benefits doesn't make any sense.
Representative Norton.
Yeah, I just want to comment on one part of your bill, and thank you for the work you've done on this. And it relates to the same comment I made before with regard to the co-payments, and I just really appreciate the work you've done. There are differences and nuances to what you're proposing, some similarities in that there are some co-pays, but the differences, one of which is that antipsychotic drugs are exempted from the co-pay. And I just think for this particular population we're working with, this is so important to make certain that they're as mentally healthy as possible so they can take care of themselves. And so, you know, we're looking at this from many areas. We're looking at it from the hospital and the support groups, and I'm looking at this from the client's perspective here, just saying I really think you've done a nice job. And I would also say if we could expand on that just a tiny bit for other life-saving medications. Certainly antipsychotics are one, but there are others, and I would certainly hate, and I did see in one other portion of the bill where the hospitals can't turn someone down for not paying the copay, which is a different part of the bill, which I thought was really nice. But please continue to work on this so that we do make certain that these folks are getting the very best care they can given the reduced benefits.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, thank you for that. We one of the constants from almost everybody that's come to talk with us about this was the importance of drug coverage for this population.
Yeah.
And so we've tried not to tinker with that at all.
And Representative Murphy, could you just talk a little bit more about the accountable care organizations and what options are going to be available to counties, I guess, as this moves forward?
This proposal uses the county as both the fiscal agent and geographical boundary for an accountable care organization. A single county or a group of counties could come together and agree to take a fixed amount of money to care for the population within its boundary. And if the county chooses not to do that, they would be paid with a fee-for-service mechanism instead. And that fee-for-service mechanism is a 50% rate reduction in terms of what would be currently paid.
What would have been paid before the veto.
Correct. Thank
yes.
you very much. We've talked some about the idea of total cost of care. We've talked some about accountable care organizations, and I think this is a part of the legislation that continues to need some work. Representative Huntley, I think, probably has the most expertise with this issue among those of us that I've been talking with on this front. And I think we need to look to the providers and the counties to see what they need in terms of making this work, what nuance in terms of policy language do they need to make it work. But this is another one of those ideas that we are taking from some of the proposals that I think you're going to hear. Some of the counties in Minnesota, especially those with a higher penetration of GAMC population, are interested in moving in this direction. So it gives us the ability to know what our costs are going to be on the front end, and it gives the providers the ability to provide the care that they think is most effective in keeping the population as healthy as possible and out of the hospital.
All right. Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy. Thanks for all your hard work on this and for reaching, particularly for your efforts reaching across the aisle. I want to go back to one question I asked Commissioner Ludeman with regards to the surcharge and where we are with the federal cap. From the way I look at it, we'd be at 4.97 without the 2% Minnesota care tax, so that would put us at almost 7% or over the federal cap by about 2 points. Is that about right, or are my numbers wrong?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, we talked with some of the providers Friday afternoon, and I think realized that we maybe have exceeded the cap, and that's not our intention. Our intention is to get just below 5%. So I think we need to see what the space in the cap get is about 1.4%. We need to see what that raises for us from the Department of Human Services. But we're not interested in exceeding that cap. That wouldn't be a very smart thing to do.
Thank you.
Representative Huntley.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, we did talk to some of the, it's both a delivery system and a insurance company to try to figure out who it is. But they think that they said that we thought, or they thought that we had gone over the limit with that, and I think they are correct. But the other thing they said is they thought we had underestimated the amount of money that we would get by that. So it's our intent to get us just below 5% and find out what that money is, and the Human Services fiscal people are looking at that today.
President Broad.
Mr. Chairman, and maybe it's better for somebody just to put a flow chart, a walkthrough of how this this surcharge actually occurs, because I think just following up on Representative Abler's comments too, I'm trying to figure out who actually, is it just the government that is billed for this increase, or with like the nursing home situation, with private payers who are seeing the increase as well. And so as we try to figure out who's actually going to see the cost increases, is it something that's handed off to all the folks who come in to a hospital? Is it just those that are paid for through government programs? Who actually sees the increase, or who will see the increase at some point? I'd love to better understand how that all kind of comes to pass.
Mr.
Chair and Representative Broad, I have a flow chart, but I do have a good description of the surcharge and how it works, which I will get to you and anybody else in the committee if you'd like. I know the folks in the Hospital Association are going to come down, and they've been the ones trying to teach me how this works, but I think essentially we would ask the hospitals to give us a percentage of their net Medicaid patient revenue, which we would then match with federal dollars, and then the hospital would get their money in return plus a little increase in their rates. So there shouldn't be a cause for cost shifting based on the surcharge alone, because we're gonna get a rate that the surcharge will be applied to the patient revenues in hospitals. It'll get matched, and then the hospitals get their money back plus a little bit.
Thank you, and Mr. Chairman, and Representative Murphy, I think that that's great. One additional thing I'd love to understand better is then how does that, does it at all impact the statement that a private payer will receive at a hospital, or the cost that they'll pay for the services? I'm hearing what you're saying on one part of it, but I'm just trying to relate it to the nursing home surcharge. And because that's the only surcharge in terms of the increase that we've seen, how it actually operates. So I guess I really want information related to how this is going to hit the folks who are out there right now struggling to pay their bills, for their own health care bills, too. But thank you very much for that information.
And I think, Mary, I think the Hospital Association can shed some light on this when they come down. So.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean. So this is a 7048-6. Is that right?
It should be the R.
Oh, R72. I'm sorry. Yeah, R72. RC72. President Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'd like to first of all thank Representative Thiessen for his holding this committee today, and also for his invitation for ideas from both sides of the aisle for moving forward on a general assistance medical care solution. And we just heard one of those solutions that involves reinstituting the general assistance medical care program. What I would like to propose is a different solution that would be working with Minnesota Care in uptaking the entirety of the general assistance medical care population and doing it through Minnesota Care, but doing it a little bit different to alleviate some of the problems that we heard about in the institution thereof. So actually what we would be talking about is a new chart of GAMC. It would be a general assistance Minnesota Care rather than a general assistance medical care program. And what we want to do is move this forward so we're worried less about maintaining a specific program and an agency and a bureaucracy, and more about focusing on getting the right care at the right place at the right time for patients within this population.
This is a very difficult population that we have dealt with, and in my three terms in the legislature, have learned a lot about this particular patient group. Chairman Bradley, I believe, in 2005 had hearings on general assistance medical care to really look at the type of patient that's involved with general assistance medical care. It's not a typical patient type. It's a very difficult type of group to cover. They tend to move in and out of hospital care, sometimes episodically, sometimes with multiple chronic conditions that make them very hard to care for. And so that their interaction with the hospital system is sometimes through the correctional system, sometimes through the emergency room, sometimes both. But they tend to be a group of patients that's very difficult to monitor. It has been said and brought up in testimony earlier that a lot of these folks present for the first time at the emergency room as some, what was described in testimony before a committee as train wrecks. They come in, the hospital put them back together, they go out, you don't hear about them, you see them again 9 or 12 months later, they come back, oh, here's Bob again, and another train wreck, he's back on GAMC, the train wreck gets fixed, and it goes back out. That certainly is the hallmark feature of people with chronic conditions, multiple conditions, mental, behavioral, chemical problems that make this population very difficult to manage. We certainly understand that. If we're looking at moving the entirety of that population into Minnesota care, I think we brought up some very important problems in accepting that. And what my bill tries to do is address some of the problems of uptake within Minnesota care to fix that transition. Number one, what I want to do is set out a set of assumptions. Number one, that all of the people within general assistance medical care, as has been brought up by Representative Huntley, are not showing up on the census at any one given time. They've moved off the grid. They're out of their six-month zone, and they're out there, but we don't know about them. So we certainly understand that that 30 to 40,000 is probably more like 70 to 80,000 moving in and out of the system. So we want to look at that as a total in terms of the census of general assistance medical care. And secondly, we want to look at that population within general assistance medical care and say, as an assumption, that some of those folks could work within the current Minnesota care program. So we've got a large group within general assistance medical care, some of which could operate functionally within Minnesota care, and then there's another group that probably doesn't work so well within Minnesota care. And so what the first part of the bill does is it directs the commissioner and the agency to do a complete census of everybody back 24 months who's been on GAMC. I've looked at a lot of the census data that we've seen, and it's somewhat incomplete in who are they, when do they present, what do they look like, what's the patient profiles within that. And so what it would do is it would direct the commissioner and the agency to basically divide Minnesota care or the general assistance medical care population into two groups. Those that can survive and do well within Minnesota care, and those that need additional help, which would be on general assistance Minnesota care, which would be a secondary population that I'll talk about in a minute. So that's really the first portion, is the direction of really a good census of the current GAMC population by the department. Now that doesn't help us with the fact that these folks are migrating over on March 1st. So what the second portion of the bill does is it deals with the uptake problems that we've heard about in moving these folks from general assistance medical care to Minnesota care. And number one, it would cover everyone under $10,000 rather than $7,500 as a movement model. It would also say that we would deal with retroactivity, and that everybody moving over or those assumed to be qualified under that $10,000 cap would be retroactively enrolled on day one, so that we would move away from the gap of up to 4 months that we talked about earlier, so that they would automatically be presumptively eligible and enrolled at the point of enrollment. So we would deal with the uptake issue within transfer from general assistance medical care to Minnesota care. And the third portion of the bill, that actually, if you go to page 3 of the bill, line 3.13, it deals with moving forward in this
General Assistance Minnesota Care model of what the best way to deal with this patient population is on a statewide basis. Now, we're dealing with a lot of the stakeholders and the folks on the committee, and one of the things that we have discovered is that the majority of these folks are either from Ramsey County or Hennepin County, and that the majority of the population of general assistance medical care is within those two counties or the seven county metro area, would be nearing 70%. So what this would do, it would be to institute a county-based medical home care model, and that would be the primary care mechanism for that. It's been brought up by several of the stakeholders that this might be not only the cheapest way to deal with this patient population, but the mechanism that delivers the best care for these folks at the right place at the right time. I was very interested to look at Dallas County, in Dallas County, Texas, that moved into a similar model of medical home care for their Medicare, Medicaid populations. And they did so not because they wanted to provide better care, but because they basically went broke. And this is the care model that they instituted and have seen not only cost reductions, but actually have seen better care, a higher quality of dignity care to the patients, and a better coordinated care model. If we are to succeed in a medical home model, it would seem that patients with chronic and multiple conditions within these parameters need a medical home probably more than any other patient in the state, and also would benefit from the most from that. So I think that that's something that's common to a common theme that has come up in looking for a more permanent resolution to this. Mr. Chun, as he helped me out with this last week, asked me to stress that this is a very schematic document and would be a sketch and not a hard-lined set of blueprint documents for moving forward. But those are the three basic pieces of it. Number one, a census study of the group. And number two, moving forward with a medical home model, and then also dealing with the uptake issues immediately within the Minnesota Care Program. And so with that, I will conclude and also be happy to entertain any questions.
Representative Bunch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, I want to ask you a little more about the medical home model. I'm not sure how this differs from what might, I assume you're talking about still under Minnesota Care. So I'm not sure, I would like further clarification what you mean by a county-based medical home versus under Minnesota Care, are just requiring anybody under Minnesota for perhaps has chronic conditions or multiple conditions to be in a healthcare home, but that could be within their health plan, but they could be required to be in a healthcare home. So could you differentiate this for me from what might exist already in terms of our goals for medical homes and other public and private programs?
President Dean.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, this would be for the secondary group that would be defined by the commissioner within Minnesota Care as a population, and it would be county-based and bid through the county system, but within Minnesota Care. And I believe if you look at 3.29, it deals with a per capita payment within the Minnesota Care system. And if that's what you're asking of which population would be within the medical home, that would be it. It would be all or none and county-based, but specifically designated for those folks within Minnesota Care as designated by the commissioner, that would be more appropriate than the general Minnesota Care program.
Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dean. I really appreciate your acknowledging that there's really subpopulations and differences within the groups that are served here. But I'm still trying to think about the factors that you see being weighed in dividing up those groups into who you think could be successful in a traditional Minnesota Care model versus this new model. And oftentimes there's been discussion, and there was discussion earlier in the hearing about people who don't fit well within systems, you know, payment structures and don't maintain checking accounts and, you know, those kinds of things. But then there's also the people who are at risk of an inpatient hospitalization. And since traditional Minnesota care has that $10,000 limit, which is a pretty low limit given current medical care prices, would you see a risk of inpatient hospitalization as one of those factors that would be looked at in this analysis?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, this does not address the $10,000 cap, and it's certainly something that could be addressed down the road dealing with that. Just in terms of separating out that patient population, you might have a 27-year-old with no insurance, recently lost a job, with one single motorcycle accident with a high cost. Getting completely rehabilitated moving forward could probably operate, you know, within this plan, you know, filling out papers, as you say, re-enrolling, those kinds of issues. And then we have other folks which are, as was pointed out to me, not exactly pamphlet readers, don't fill out forms, don't have an address that it's just not going to work for, and that's the secondary group.
Over from Lindley.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, I'm just looking at this for the first time, and first of all, I just want to say I appreciate your work on this, and, you know, that you're trying to think about a solution, too. And, you know, I have to, as I'm looking at what you're proposing here, I'm kind of thinking back to our steadfast plan again, and, you know, that we worked a long time on county-based purchasing, and this looks to be a little bit like that. But I just want to point out what I think I'm seeing as the real difference here between what the counties wanted to do on a new county-based purchasing plan and what I think you're proposing here, although there are some real similarities. When we were negotiating with the health plans over this proposal to do Steadfast, well, let me just remind you, the only thing that our bill really had in it, the only change it made that the counties needed in order to get their plan going, the only real change, because current law absolutely would allow them to do it already, that what they needed to make a financial go of it was to say that when a person goes on the public programs, which would be either GAMC or Minnesota Care, and they didn't select a plan, that they would default to the county's plan. That's all the bill did, okay? That's what the governor vetoed. They didn't, the plans, I think, I'm not sure why he vetoed it really, but I think that there was, the economic model there didn't work for everybody, okay? What the plans came to us toward the end of all of this as we were about to bring the bill up on the House floor and wanted to make a deal where we would, where the counties would take the GAMC people, all of them. So I think what we're talking about here is a population, the GAMC population, that even if you take them and you manage their care better, which is something we absolutely should be doing, and I really like the idea of having the counties be involved in that, but and I hope the counties will speak to this, but it looks to me like the economic model that's being proposed here of having the counties take off the most expensive, hard-to-manage patients for not more than the plans get paid for the easier to care for, less expensive patients, but that's just a big shifting of cost to counties. What the counties wanted to do was have a mix of those patients, and what the plans wanted to do is have only the less expensive patients, if I'm articulating this well enough and you're following me. So I'm sure the counties will speak for themselves on this, but I'm thinking that the problem with this idea is that you're giving the counties the highest cost people for the same price. And I think that what gives the health plans, what keeps them in the game with our Minnesota Care people is that they make money off of that, whereas just the GAMC people, I kind of don't think that's going to work that way.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, you bring up some excellent points, and one of those points that I forgot to bring up that the counties are not going to like is that I am within this piece of legislation requesting that the counties uptake the entirety of the Minnesota Care premium up to $10,000. So let me thank you for reminding me to give them that bit of news. The second portion of your statement is that this would be optional by the county. Some counties with a big population of GAMC or now, you know, General Assistance Minnesota Care population folks might opt to take it. For example, Hennepin County, Ramsey County, Watonwan County probably wouldn't. So they would revert back to the Minnesota Care, straight up Minnesota Care program. But it would be all or nothing, county by county.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Jean, I also appreciate the thought you put into this. Well, you had me until you said Texas. No, I had a question on the, on the county-based focus during times like these, everyone's talking about, you know, why do we need 87 counties and so on, and should we consolidate into, you know, multi-county human service agencies. I'm wondering if you would entertain an idea about, granted, we're talking about just Ramsey and Hennepin County for a lot of the patients, but I could say, I don't know, Washington and Chisago County, for example, might coordinate on some of this formerly GAMC population that would be under your hard-to-handle group that might migrate from one side to the other, and it might be actually easier for groups of counties to coordinate. So there might be some permissive language that says counties might combine in terms of administering a healthcare home for this kind of population so that corrections and hospitals and human services organizations can all be on the same page rather than just worry about where the border is.
That's an excellent suggestion. Maybe Mr. Chung could let me know whether or not that's possible within this, and maybe he'd have a comment to that. As for Texas, don't misunderestimate him.
Wow. Mr. Chairman and Representative Gardner, sometimes Texas has it right. You know, their legislature only meets every other year. So, actually, my question is not necessarily for Representative Dean, but actually for Mr. Chun. I'm just thinking about Representative Dean's news to the counties that they're going to have the uptake of the premium. I'm wondering, actually, a hospital board member contacted me just recently asking me if a foundation, a lot of hospitals have a foundation or a nonprofit entity other than just the nonprofit of the hospital itself. But is there an opportunity or is there a state law that creates a barrier to a foundation actually helping pay the premiums for these folks? Their understanding or the understanding of this person who contacted me was that there was actually a barrier to a foundation providing that premium payment.
Mr. Chun. Sheriff DeBroad, I guess I've heard that as an issue as well. I did sort of raise the issue with department staff, and I think they basically said that they weren't really giving individual entities sort of legal advice about this. I think the issue is probably with the federal, say, you know, the Medicare, Medicaid type anti-kickback laws where it could be viewed as maybe offering an inducement. But I really don't know much about this area, but I've heard the issue as well.
Mr. Chairman,
I
don't know if it'd be worthwhile, but Representative Dean, I don't know if you'd be willing to work with me on trying to clarify that so that we don't have folks who are getting into legal trouble accidentally. But it seems to me that if there's groups out there that might be willing to do that in order to get people covered in a way that makes more sense, we shouldn't have barriers in the way.
Okay. It looks like you will. Yes. All right. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Representative Dean. I appreciate it. And we'll continue the discussion on all this as well. Okay. Hennepin County, I think there's... You want to... Is there several of you going to come down?
I'm going to go first.
Sure, yeah. Welcome, Commissioner. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee.
first and foremost, I want to thank you for your efforts to find a solution to the general assistance medical care crisis we face today. We in Hennepin County are appreciative of your thoughts and your efforts, including your tour throughout the state this past summer, Friday, July 3rd, at Hennepin County Medical Center, and your meetings throughout the fall. I'm here today reflecting my concern for the health of the state's population with unique perspective as the chair of the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners and as a member of the Hennepin Healthcare System or the Hennepin County Medical Center Board. It's no great news that both organizations are very concerned about the termination of the GAMC program. Hennepin County residents and HCMC will suffer the greatest impact of the program's termination. You are by now, you are very familiar with the basic numbers. 40% of the GAMC enrollees live in Hennepin County, and HCMC's payments for services will be reduced by $50 million annually, nearly 10% of our current revenue. I take this opportunity to remind you of our collaborative work in the past to assure we are getting high value for the expenditure of public resources for healthcare. We've been concerned about the cost of healthcare, particularly as it relates to public financing. As a result, since legislation was passed in 2005 that enabled us to change the governance structure of HCMC, we have actively been continuing to transform the hospital into a lean and flexible health system. Since 2007, the operation of HCMC has been overseen by a diverse, competency-oriented-based board, able to provide focus solely on HCMC and its clinics. There have been major changes in personnel and to the major operational systems at the hospital. For example, an electronic health record is now in play at the hospital and clinic. Purchasing, human resources systems have been revised. We continue to provide excellent trauma and emergency care while expanding our commitment to primary care. We have been actively engaged in the state's efforts in healthcare reform. We are about providing efficient service at the appropriate site of care. Our clinic system will see more than 360,000 visits this year. How are we performing? To date, we have been able to manage our operations to adjust to other rate reductions we have experienced. For instance, our base inpatient rates are currently based on 2004 costs, less 15%. In essence, we fall for $88 million of cuts by reducing rates by operating within rate decreases imposed on us, upon us. We have right-sized our operation to respond to the unallotment of last December and the rate reductions of the 2009 legislative session, with two waves of reductions in force in the last 12 months. Since 2007, our cost increases have been at or below healthcare inflation rates. And our staffing levels, as measured by a full-time equivalent for adjusted occupied bed, and I state that acronym because it's one the county board and the health system board have focused on, have been reduced by 9% since 2006. These dramatic steps will allow the property tax subsidy to be limited to $30 million in 2009. I say limited to $30 million. So I can tell you we have been on the path to deliver effective performance within public sector sensitivity. Then, after all that, boom, and it's not in bold or large-faced type on my remarks, but it should be, rather than a deliberative, systematic transformation of the financing system as our care model and operation changes, we're effectively thrown off a cliff with the proposed elimination of GAMC. We fully understand the state's budget problem. We at the county board deal with it every day. We have concerns about the state stepping away from what has been a commitment to providing programs that cover our poorest population. And in doing so in a fashion that is so abrupt that it jeopardizes institutions that are essential to the quality of life for all Minnesotans. It is simply unreasonable for the state to abrogate responsibility in this fashion and to expect Hennepin County taxpayers to make up the shortfall. Tomorrow, at the last Hennepin County board meeting of the year, we will approve our budget. Within our overall budget, we will approve HCMC's operating budget that includes a $25 million loss. This is a crisis and a step toward a catastrophic spiral that could jeopardize HCMC as the hallmark Minnesota institution it is. So in summary, in Hennepin County, we are doing our part to provide a lean and effective safety net system. My ask of your committee and to the legislature and the governor, find the ways and means to maintain coverage for the poorest of our poor, or find ways to support those institutions like HCMC that will be the sites at which the uninsured seek their care. My offer to the committee
is that HCMC and the county staff will work with you to fashion creative responses. We will share our research. We will share our talent. We will share our direct experience of dealing with people who are in these find themselves in need of this kind of care. We will bolster EHS theoretical projections with our knowledge of how these patients currently live in real time, in real life situations. Finally, I would ask that you appreciate as you go forward, there is a difference between cuts to the benefit set of GAMC and elimination of the program as it exists. There is a difference between Minnesota care as a theoretical option and health care to a difficult population in reality on the street. There is a difference between a state insurance program and a county-mandated, or state-mandated, property tax-funded, risk-laden new responsibility to counties. And there is a difference between health care standards worthy of Minnesota and stepping over people on the street. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions for the commissioner? Okay, and you're going to, I think the other folks from Hennepin County present the proposal. Thank you for coming.
Mr. Gaffney here to answer technical questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to share with you our proposal on redesigning GAMC and coming up with a new care model for the population. We'd also like to thank you for the opportunity to provide some feedback to the legislative proposals that have been offered thus far. We'd like to recognize all the hard work you put into this effort. As you've already heard from Commissioner Opat, the elimination of GAMC will have a devastating impact on HCMC and the people we serve. Doing nothing is not an option for our hospital. We have, however, realized that in the current political...
Mr. Godfrey, can you just say your name for the record?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is David Godfrey from Hennepin County Medical Center.
Thank you.
We realize in the current political and budgetary environment that GAMC in its current form is not sustainable. Furthermore, we recognize there is a need to pursue a reform of the program which creates healthcare delivery systems for these enrollees, which is more effective and less costly. To this end, we've developed a proposal with four aims in mind: reform, fiscal stability, access, and lower costs. And at this point, I'd just like to go over our proposal, and you can follow along my remarks. I hopefully the committee has this in their packet.
Should be in your packet.
I should say from the beginning that our proposal has been a work in progress, and it continues to evolve as we receive more input from legislators, other stakeholders, and our internal leadership. We have had the pleasure of meeting with many of you to discuss this, our ideas, and while the core concepts of our proposal remain the same, some details may have changed since we last shared them with you. Our proposal would create a comprehensive benefit for GAMC enrollees who have one of five qualifiers. And those are those who receive tax assistance awaiting disability determination, homeless, have end-stage renal disease, or state-funded chemical dependency treatment. These are the same five qualifiers which are present in the DFL bill for those who have continuous GAMC coverage. Those without one of the five qualifiers would be eligible for a catastrophic hospitalization program under GAMC hospital-only program that currently exists in law. Essentially, we are proposing that you would expand that program to 75% or below of poverty. Currently, it's between 75 and 175 of poverty. We'd also provide a limited outpatient benefit of $500. After 2 months of coverage, these enrollees would be eligible to apply for Minnesota Care, but we would not pursue or establish auto-enrollment. Instead, resources would be provided to counties and providers to facilitate GHO participants' enrollment into Minnesota Care. For individuals with a comprehensive benefit set, we propose that they be provided through one of two delivery models determined by a county. The first would be a fee-for-service option administered by the county, by the state. The other would be a combination of an accountable care organization for some populations and fee-for-service for the remainder. The An ACO, as has already been noted by Representative Murphy, is a local integrated provider network that would receive a global payment for a set of services provided to the population, specific population. We think that the ACO incentivized providers to provide the lowest cost, most effective care because providers must live within a capitated payment. And we also believe that PAMT enrollees participating in the ACO would benefit from greater care coordination. Other features of our ACO proposal would include a minimum benefit set established in state law. The county may add to the benefit set. The county may also pool local or other funds used for support or social services that are not currently reimbursed by GAMC, and counties could join with other counties to form ACOs. Also, consistent with the DFL proposal released on Thursday, we would maintain a separate pharmacy benefit fee-for-service that would be reimbursed at 100% of today's rate. The financial risk would be borne by the ACO, not the county. To ensure that the ACO remains solvent financially, ACOs should be required to obtain stop-loss coverage through either the private sector or obtain it from the state. If it was provided by the state, potentially a program like GHO could be used as the stop-loss, covering claims above a certain threshold, $100,000, $200,000. I'm unsure what the exact cutoff would be, but the analysis could be done. An ACO, we envision, would be governed by an independent board. The board would be provider and member-driven. The legal entity, this would be the legal entity that would have the financial relationship with the state. We envision that there would be a role for a need for a third-party administrator that that would handle claims and counter data among providers in this network. A health plan, county-based purchasing group, or the provider network itself could function as the TPA. Incentives for quality and efficiency would be established through shared savings and possibly through withholds. And to allow for the implementation of the ACO, we believe that a later start date than is in the current proposal, perhaps January 1st, 2011, may be more feasible in terms of trying to actually develop substantial ACO options. We, in terms of fiscal stability and lower costs, we would suggest a funding provided through a direct cap appropriation, which would be indexed to healthcare inflation. Funds for the ACO would be distributed. ACOs would be distributed proportionally based on 2009 spending for the populations that are served by the ACOs. Fee-for-service appropriation, which would be capped, could be managed with quarterly or bimonthly settle-ups through ratable reductions if necessary. The savings in this program are derived through rate reductions in fee-for-service. We would propose a 30% reduction from fiscal year 2009 GAMC spending. Rate reductions should be structured in such a way to target resources so cuts are less devastating to providers with the highest concentration of GAMC patients. Funds set aside for ACOs would be equal to 30% reduction in current GAMC spending for the population served by the ACO or covered by the ACO. And that, in a nutshell, is our proposal. And then we have some reactions to at least the bill that was released on Thursday or Wednesday. And unfortunately, we haven't had an opportunity to look at Representative Dean's proposal in any detail. But we'll continue. We'd like to say, regarding the proposal...
Before we do that, are there any questions on the Hennepin County proposal?
I'm Mike Harris. I'm a Vice President for Public Policy and Strategy at HCMC. And that means I do strategic planning as well as public policy. And I probably should tie a little bit of this together, Commissioner Opat's comments and David's. David has talked a lot about some of the potential options, some of the details of the concept. You heard from Commissioner Opat that we need the money. Well, you know we need the money. We do need the money, but we also need to bring more to you and the administration than simply that. So we wanted to come forward with the concept oriented to all of the work that's been going on in Minnesota, to your credit and the governor, about reform in the last couple of years. We, I think Representative Murphy said, here's an idea we're not entirely in love with, and that's true. It's complicated, as we've laid it out, but at the same time, it is an evolution or a step toward trying to rein in and bring some rationality to the increasing costs of health care. We would hope that the legislation that does pass February 4th is going to be permissive. We don't have the details worked out. We need flexibility not only for units of government, but some of the very fine healthcare systems. We talked about the fact that Hennepin has built a substantial outpatient system. So have the Fairviews, so have the Alinas, so have the Ascensias and others. So we are here to encourage you and appreciate the work you're doing to find a solution, recognizing what we're bringing forward are some concepts that we hope can be made workable. Hennepin County, specifically, Commissioner Opat, at this stage, is not able to say we're absolutely on the board of this concept around an accountable care entity, but we think it is a step toward what will be a solution as we move forward. So I just thought I would make some of those comments because this does need to be an evolving work in process in the weeks ahead. And as Commissioner Opat said, we're going to do everything we can to be as responsive to you as we all puzzle our way through a solution.
Thank you. I'm Representative Ava.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I met with these, they came to my office, Mr. Godfrey in particular. And if most members don't recognize him, you haven't had the privilege of being on a conference committee in the human service world. He came out of the Senate. One of the best things the Senate has generated in quite a long time, I think. In terms of... anyway, he's quite... sorry, just tell him I said that. Anyway, he's... Hennepin County Hospital is lucky to get him on their staff. There's a lot of technical stuff he went through, but it's really nice to have a person with expertise like that coming from there. And I wanted to comment on the idea here. I like a lot of it. I see it as realistic and pragmatic. I facing what we're facing, the $1.2 billion and the $5.4 billion and all that $1 billion shortfalls, if we can't change expectations in part of our system, we are going to be just in terrible harm's way. And I see this as a way to do part of that, where they do some triage of who they're going to serve more intensely. This accountable care organization, I think, has a lot of possibilities, not just for this population, but maybe even for the MA hospital population, the non-disabled part. The health plans will have a heart attack as they hear me say that. But I think that, there's enough structure here that, you know, there's some good things about the plan we heard earlier, too, and I'm interested to hear their reactions to what they think about that part. But I think that this is a good place for level three to exist, I think, in this population, especially where they're so hospital-heavy. And so the hospitals and the ACOs would be driven to find better ways to serve these folks and just, you know, fixing their bleeding head when they come in, but, you know, in emergency care. But they also would find a way to bring in more primary care in some other ways. 24-hour clinics where they're just regular clinic, you know, and they wouldn't have to be staffing up and so on. And so it may well be that some of the providers in the network may get par or better than par pay because they want to keep their primary care people working. I will stop there, but I'm happy they came in and especially to comment that this is a proposal by a group, by an entity that is telling us how they can make it do with a little bit less. Not happy to have the less, but they're looking at the reality of it. And I think that's a hard place for us to get to, but I think it's where it is. And as I read the comments by different people running for other offices, how do you get $5 billion in a tax increase? It's just not going to happen. So how are you going to do something to do better ways, different ways to do it? And I think this is one of those ways. So, and I look forward to working with them.
Thank you. How are you paying for this?
Mr. Chair, our approach to this proposal has been to develop a model by which this program could be delivered at less cost, 75-60% less cost. That's where we think our expertise lies. We think that others are probably better suited to propose revenue sources. With that said, the revenue sources that have been mentioned or set out in the proposal from last week, I think we are interested in learning more about them, and that I can't say that we support them necessarily without going back and talking with our folks. I do know that we have some concerns with the county share. I would probably object to that. But other than that, we support the creative thinking that's gone on around the revenue that, or the funding sources that have been brought forth thus far.
Okay, thank you. And you said you had a couple of comments. If we could do like 3 minutes.
Yep.
Thanks.
Yep. Mr. Chair, member, just to comment on the proposal, Representative Murphy's proposal. We would like to support the fact that it maintains coverage for most of the GMC population. We also appreciate that it's a recognition that Minnesota Care is not an appropriate program for most of the current GMC enrollees. It continues to provide coverage for most current participants from the date of application. The recognition that the resources should be targeted to providers with a disproportionate share of GMC enrollees, we appreciate. We also appreciate that the bill authorizes ACOs and looks at creative ways of delivering health care to this population. And in terms of our concerns, we're concerned with the exclusion of GMC GHO to those currently covered between 75 and 175% of poverty. This is the only program that provides retroactive hospitalization coverage for this population. Without it, HCMC and other safety net hospitals will see additional uncompensated care costs. Regarding the ACO provisions in the bill, we'd like to see additional options provided for counties to establish ACOs for a specific subset of the GMC population based on certain characteristics, whether those are chronic illness, housing status, geography, and allow for fee-for-service for the remainder of those enrollees in a particular county. We think it's important to look at provisions related to or to stem the potential of unlimited risk to ACOs to see if there's creative ways we can do that through either purchasing stop loss or reinsurance through the private sector or through the state. And finally, I've already mentioned the flexibility on the implementation date that we think is needed. And finally, while we appreciate the targeting of resources in the proposal to safety net providers and others who have a disproportionate share of GMC patients, especially hospitals, we believe that rate cuts that are too significant have the potential to severely limit access and create further cost shifting to other safety net providers.
Okay. You get all that, Representative Murphy? All right. Representative Abel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I should probably apologize to the Senate. I didn't mean it. But you don't know what a person's like, you see him at 5 in the morning after being up all night and watch him still come up with amendments. But I just wanted to offer one more thought. And as this goes forward, I don't know why a hospital group couldn't be an ACO, and that's just a county. Like, Alina's big, and some ones are not probably Bowabic Hospital, unless they wanted to do it, if they even have a Bowabic Hospital. But I think that this is maybe a good place to try level 3. So too bad Chair Huntley is not here to hear me say that. He would have been happy to.
We'll let him know.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you so much for your help. Appreciate it. We're going to bounce around a little bit to accommodate a few schedules. So to ask me, I don't know what your how you want to proceed, but. Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, Chairman Chasen and committee members. We want to thank you for the opportunity to weigh in on alternative proposals to restore general medical care. My name is Elliot Seib. I'm the Executive Director of Aspen, Minnesota Council 5. Our union represents about 3,300 workers employed at hospitals that provide charity care. That includes 1,500 Aspen jobs at Hennepin County Medical Center, 900 Aspen jobs at Regents Hospital, and 900 Aspen jobs at Fairview University Medical Center. A caregiver from each of these hospitals is here with me today, and they'll share their stories right after I conclude. Loss of GAMC funding would cripple our safety net hospitals. HCMC would lose 10% of its revenue, starting with $43 million in 2010. Regions would lose $24 million in 2010. Fairview would lose $14.7 million in GAMC billings for 16 months beginning March 1st. These cuts will trigger service cuts and long lines for emergency room services. Instant medical attention can mean the difference between life and death if you're burned or injured in a car accident, if your heart stops, if you're ready to give birth prematurely. This is just not an issue for poverty. It's an issue for workers, for middle-class Minnesotans, for all Minnesotans. Cuts will also force hundreds of layoffs, starting with 200 at HCMC. That's a dangerous prescription that will weaken our economy and our healthcare system. Governor Pawlenty's decision to eliminate GAMC is yet another attack on our poorest, sickest, and most vulnerable neighbors. But they're not the only victims. His cuts will only lead to increased healthcare costs and loss of jobs. That's salt in the wounds of frontline hospital workers who are doing their part to keep services going during these very tough times. For AFSCME, a solution must accomplish three things. First, we must preserve full medical services for 30,000 of our poorest and sickest neighbors, many of whom are mentally ill and homeless. Secondly, protect our safety net hospitals as strong community assets. And third, last but not least, save hundreds of hospital jobs that would be lost if GAMC is eliminated on March 1st. The battle now is how to pay for a solution. AFSCME prefers a fix that relies on new revenue rather than deeper cuts to hospitals. We oppose the governor's plan to automatically enroll GAMC recipients in MinCare. In case the committee doesn't know, Mr. Chairman, there's already a waiting list of 10,000 people with a three-month wait just to see if they're eligible in MinCare already, prior to any of this automatic enrollment. His plan only kicks the problem down the road and would eventually bankrupt the healthcare access fund. His solution is flawed because it relies on premiums and copays that impoverished people can't afford. It also has a $10,000 cap on inpatient hospitalizations, which most patients will exceed. While the DFL's temporary 16-month fix raises some revenue, and we appreciate the work that's been done on it, AFSCME is concerned that a pared-down version of GAMC benefits that cuts eligibility and payments to hospitals. We need to know its net revenue impact on each of the hospitals where we represent the people who deliver the services. AFSCME supports health care reforms that will retain access to health care for those now on GAMC, avoid cuts to clients and hospitals, and lower overall costs while preserving services. To do that, we support using the state medical review team to shift some GAMC recipients onto federal programs for which they qualify. We also need outreach to homeless veterans who are now on GAMC and might qualify for VA funding. For the long run, it also makes sense to us to use evidence-based coordinated care to improve treatment and lower costs for the chronically ill. We need bridge funding to get through June 30th, 2011 to keep GAMC clients from being denied coverage and to allow time for a new governor and legislature to develop a long-term solution for the next biennium. This funding needs to be provided early in the session, but within the context of the budget deficit we face for the current biennium. For bridge funding, we support one or more of the following options. An increase in the provider tax to 3% effective March 1st, 2010. This would yield about $87 million in the remainder of fiscal year 2010, plus an estimated $293 million in fiscal year 2011. An increase in the alcohol beverage excise tax and gross receipts tax, as passed by the legislature last year. This would yield up to $152 million in fiscal year 2011 and could be used for chemical dependency treatment and public safety programs. An increase in the medical assistance surcharge, as suggested in the DFL plan. This could draw a federal match and yield, we believe, $165 million in the current biennium. It's not enough only to restore the $396 million that Governor Pawlenty cut from GAMC. We must raise revenue fairly. Restoring GAMC without raising revenue will force this committee and the legislature to cannibalize other public services that people need during tough times. To provide a stable future for GAMC and other vital public services, we must fix the $1.2 billion budget deficit for the current biennium. To raise that revenue, AFSCME urges you to require the wealthiest Minnesotans to pay their fair share of income taxes. It would be great if federal health care reform covered GAMC recipients by 2013. Ironically, we will pay for that primarily by increasing the federal income tax. Mr. Chairman, members, we have three employees, workers, who deliver services to Minnesotans. And if it's all right with the chairman, I'd ask them now, starting with Mr. Steve Fitch from Local 1164 Fairview University Medical Center.
Welcome to the committee. Just identify yourself before you give your testimony. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stephen Fitz. As a nursing station technician at the University of Minnesota Medical Center, I assist 4 to 6 registered nurses in caring for up to 24 highly acute care patients. I'd like to draw your attention to one of the many implications for all of our patients, not just GAMC recipients, if this funding isn't restored. It's already a common occurrence for every staff member to be occupied in a patient's room, leaving call lights to go off until someone is free to answer. Every staff reduction forced by these cuts will increase that frequency and that wait time. Now, if the patient needs help ordering breakfast, this is a frustration. If the patient is unable to breathe, the implications are obviously much more dire. This is not the quality of care that we want, my coworkers and I want to provide. This is not the quality of care that we are capable of providing. Most importantly, this is not the quality of care that our patients expect and deserve. Thank you very much, and thank you also to the committee and the chair for allowing us to move up in the rotation a little bit, and I am actually late for work at the moment, so thank you very much.
Thank you for staying and for coming today.
Mr. Chairman, sir, I'd like to call on Judy Minter from Regents.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, members of the board. My name is Judy Minter, and I'm here today to share with you some of the concerns that I have heard our patients at Regents Hospital. I have been employed with Regents Hospital for 8 years in the housekeeping department. I hear the concerns, the fears and of the patients and their families about having to face their medical assistance being cut and also having medical treatment. Every day when I go to work, I wear a badge on my chest. And on that badge is a mission statement from Regents Hospital. And it does read, "Our mission is to improve the health of our patients and community by providing high-quality health care which meets the needs of all people. I hope you will join our mission to improve the service for our patients and all Minnesotans." Thank you very much, board members.
Thank you. Our next speaker, Mr. Chairman, is Brian McNeil. From Local 2474, and Mr. McNeil works at Hennepin County Medical Center.
Yes. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brian McNeil. I'm an inpatient social worker in the medical intensive care units at Hennepin County Medical Center. I appreciate the opportunity to make a few comments to the committee. AFSCME has asked me to describe to you some of the patients that we see at HCMC who would be affected by the decision to end the GAMC funding. HIPAA regulations prohibit me from giving you details of specific patients, but nevertheless, this is not a difficult task. Those affected would be working-age adults without dependent children. They are our sisters, our brothers. They are our fathers and our mothers. They are our nieces and nephews, cousins, neighbors, and friends. They are above all workers who, for one reason or another, are unemployed or working part-time for little pay. Many of them are struggling with addiction and mental health issues. Many of them are young. The majority of GAM recipients that I see are homeless. So who are they? That is a pretty simple question. The bigger question, more complicated one, is who are we? Who are we as we treat the poor and vulnerable among us? The more important question that the legislature and the governor must answer and will answer is this one. Who are we as a state and a society that would allow the poor, the homeless, and the unemployed to go without health insurance? Ending GAMC will result in more workers without insurance because I am absolutely certain, and you should be too, that replacing GAMC with Minnesota Care or and the alternatives recommended or suggested here today will result in more people unemployed, more people not completing their paperwork, and not being able to pay the premiums that are being suggested. Thank you.
Can I, if it's all right, I'd like to just ask a quick follow-up question. So as people come in, do you think that there is a potential for some of this process to do better by helping people manage their care? I mean, that's kind of part of the role you play, I would assume, in your role at the hospital. So, I mean, is there a place where we can actually improve how people get their health care? Kind of setting aside the money issue, but just the delivery system reform?
Hennepin does a great job, I think, in enrolling people. As the Senator Representative said earlier, most of the people who end up on GAMC don't plan it. They end up in the hospital, and HCMC has a department of people who come and interview these patients and do the application for the Department of Human Services to get them on insurance. And I think Hennepin is doing, HCMC is all I can speak about, is doing as much as it can to get these people enrolled.
And beyond enrolling, you also direct them to, if they, you know, if it is a person with a chronic condition, say diabetes or something, to try to direct them to a place where they can better manage their care on a kind of on an ongoing basis.
We always do pay attention to follow up care and refer patients to outpatient clinics, usually the Hennepin clinics. With respect to the senator's proposal about home care options, there is a similar thing going on now with emergency medical assistance. And the problem is that the patients don't, I mean, they might be assigned to Hennepin, but then they show up at North or they show up at Regions. And so that's one problem. This is not a population that plans well, and they might easily show up at different hospitals. And then you have a bureaucratic issue.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's helpful. Thank you very much for coming down and for sharing your comments. We always appreciate it.
Thanks for having us early, Mr. Chairman.
Is Monica? Okay, yes. And is Mr. Fisher with you? Well, why don't we have Mr. Fisher go first, if that's okay. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and the committee members. Some of you have heard my story before, but I just wanted to make a couple of quick points. First of all, my name is Robert Fisher, for the record. I don't know if I said that or not. I am a lifelong resident of the state of Minnesota. I was a successful business owner. I was a homeowner, and I paid taxes most of that time. And then, basically, I had a series of events that happened. One, I had a huge business crisis, which caused financial burden, and then I had a health crisis that lasted about a year. Consequently, I became homeless. Well, actually, our house went into foreclosure, and we ended up filing bankruptcy. Just when we thought it couldn't get any worse, we were going to go pick up the equity from our home, and when we went there, because we were 8 hours late, that was not forthcoming, and that's how I found out we were homeless and penniless. That was the day that I basically snapped. I went into a vortex of despair and depression, which the likes I hope I never see again. It's taken me a number of years to crawl out of this, and I have done that through GAMC. For me, you know, now my life, through those years, my life has actually come around very, very well. And I've got a number of opportunities right now. And so GAMC is not going to affect me directly. I'm just soon be employed and working, and a lot of these opportunities have come with my work in helping save GAMC. It's not going to affect me directly, but I have met hundreds and hundreds of people through my little adventure into poverty, and I'm here for them. There are many of them just do not have the capacity to follow through even with Minnesota Care. A lot of them don't have addresses. There's no way of contacting them. There's a lot of issues of follow through and having them follow through. And I worry about them. For me, historically, Minnesota has been a culture of compassion. And it appears to me that's changed, and changed radically. These cuts, I think, will devastate the lives of many, many people. You know, for me, GAMC was there when I needed it. And it was great. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to do what I've done, and I really believe that I would be dead. That's how serious this is for me, anyway. You know, I did pay my taxes before, and I will be paying my taxes again, and I will actually be grateful to do that. I want to thank you for your time, and thank you.
Thank you. Questions for members? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Monica Nielsen and Maureen O'Connell.
Welcome to committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Monica Nielsen. I am the president of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, a coalition of 150 programs statewide concerned with homelessness. Today, I am the director of street outreach for St. Stephen's Human Services, working primarily with those who are unsheltered and sleeping outside. I am also here as part of the Save PAMC Coalition. You can see a number of members wearing stickers in the room. A group of organizations that draw from the faith, labor, homeless, low-income advocacy, and other groups that have come together out of our shared concern about preserving health coverage for the men and women on PAMC. Organizations included in this effort include the Minnesota Nurses Association, Legal Services Advocacy Project, Take Action Minnesota, Catholic Charities, FEIU, Churches United in Ministry in Duluth, the Affirmative Options Coalition, and dozens of others. Over the past few months, these organizations have coordinated our grassroots and policy advocacy activities to ensure that the public is educated about the impact of the elimination of PAMC. But first, a note. I'd like to tell you about Kevin. Kevin showers with his clothes on. His body is so bloated from illness and weak to respond that it's simpler that way. His caregivers could possibly help him out, but since they are operating a homeless shelter, they need to balance his needs with those of dozens of others. So instead, they'll give him extra towels. Our interests in the coalition are the people. That's where our focus is. Some of those who are on GAMC are in this room, but for others, this room is too polite. But make no mistake, those living in psychoses who are walking around outside right now need care. Michelle, who called me this morning and slept in the hospital last night, needs care. Her friend who slept on the floor, because since you're allowed one overnight visitor, why not shelter two for the price of one? She needs care too. There are 305 others whose videos were taped by St. Stephen's Human Rights Program that are in need. You can see their videos on our website. Included in your packet is a survey conducted by Catholic Charities. Over 100 people responded with their concerns about clients of managed care. The three key findings are that care management services provided by health plans are not adequate, that community service agencies commonly provide health care related case management, and that successful care management for GAMC enrollees requires preventative, culturally competent care, and outreach on the ground in locations that GAMC folks frequent. For some, managed care works. Clients have successful outcomes because they are not, quote-unquote, service resistant. For others, this is the extent of their managed care. This is not a handout for you. I'm sure you're happy about that. This is the current mail, just from two places, from St. Stephen's and from Listening House in St. Paul, where I was at this morning. These are the packets we receive when they enroll in care. Sorry, I can't see some of you. We will send these back after 30 days to make room for the new ones. Now, you can imagine if other providers in the room had brought their mail. The reality is that care coordination for my folks is my BlackBerry. Medical transportation is my Jetta. And personal care attendance services take the form of Henry, the homeless wheelchair-bound senior, keeping a can of air freshener between his legs and his wheelchair, because in the absence of having someone to help him bathe, he states with humility, "I don't want to leave my odor behind when I leave you." Don't take comfort that many who don't utilize health care programs must not need care. I wish I were out right now with the other outreach workers who left earlier, trying to convince the psychotic to come in tonight when it's minus 10. This is bothering me, sorry. Instead, I'll be driving them to the emergency room tomorrow with frostbite, as I did earlier this week. There are others who couldn't be here today. Jim, who called to ask, "My blood pressure is 230 over 180. Is that bad?" A client of Minnesota Care, Jim had not paid his premium of $45 last month. He had had some work in the past year, but is now receiving general assistance of $203 a month. With a premium over 20% of his income, more urgent needs took precedence. So now, the next month, he has no insurance. He asked if I could buy his two blood pressure meds for $95. My answer, no. He returned to the garage in which he sleeps. While I discourage those who support panhandlers, in Mary's case, she really is signing in part for her co-pays. After she lost her job, she started donating plasma, but after her 280th visit, they said her blood levels were too unstable, so she started panhandling off 94 in April. I won't talk much about what this stress does to direct service homeless advocates, police officers, or healthcare providers. Our trauma is only secondary. I will state the obvious. Housing is healthcare to our people. Housing is healthcare. With regard to the census study that Representative Dean spoke of earlier, I guess I just want to offer a census study that Representative Dean spoke of earlier. I guess I just want to offer a note of concern that if the state is hoping to have outreach workers help find those GAMC recipients living outside in order to be surveyed in the next month, we could use some help, and I would suggest you wear wool. My main point is this. We have to meet people where they are at. If they are on the street, we need managed care there. If they are in supportive housing, we need staff there. We need a care delivery model and an eligibility and enrollment process that works for our people, that is flexible. Before I turn it over to Maureen O'Connell, who is going to go a little deeper into the policy, I will leave you with this. What if we don't have service-resistant clients, but we have client-resistant services?
Ms. O'Connell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maureen O'Connell, and I'm the Advocacy Director for Legal Aid. I'm here today also representing the Save GMC Coalition. First, we'd like to start out by thanking the Chair and Representatives Murphy and Thiessen and Representative Dean for the solutions that they've brought forward. We have appreciated the opportunities that we have had to give input and see our input is reflected in the solutions. We appreciate the framework laid out in the DFL proposal that preserves eligibility and benefits for tens of thousands of our poorest adults. Our coalition has spent the last 6 months examining the data regarding GAMC. we've tried to do the census that Representative Dean talked about. We have analyzed who is on the program, the eligibility and enrollment process, and the care delivery model. We have learned DMC is truly a safety net program that provides coverage to tens of thousands. Of Minnesotans who not only are sick, but also often lack housing and live on the margins. But it seems to us that it should not have been so hard. As part of our analysis, we tried to look at how we deliver and pay for the health care services for Kevin and Michelle and Jim and Henry and Mary. And it has been a very difficult process and quite a challenge. So going forward, we as a coalition strongly recommend to legislators that as we rebuild GMC, we must have a more transparent program that allows for all of the various stakeholders the opportunity to compare utilization, know why costs are increasing, and know a whole lot more about the healthcare outcomes for the population. While the health plans provide massive amounts of data to the Department of Human Services, from our examination, it is difficult to determine how it is strategically used by DHS. And there is little data available for public examination. We must have transparency as we assess and compare new care models. Which brings me to our next point. In the proposals that we have seen coming forward, we strongly support new care models for this population. Our examination confirms that we do need new care models that better serve. Thus, we fully support establishing demonstration projects that build on current state and national health care reform ideas, projects that aim to achieve better health outcomes and reduce public program costs. We are very interested in helping to develop either accountable care organizations, health care homes, or basket of care models. We believe that we should be looking at a variety of demonstration projects. So we could support Representative Deans, we could support accountable care organizations. We looked at it as looking at the date of January 1st, 2011 as a time when a variety of demonstration projects could start up and perhaps run for the next 2 to 3 years until we had healthcare reform, national healthcare reform, when this population is more than likely going to be transferred on to medical assistance. Because we see this population, where we differ from some of the testimony that's been given today and why we do not support the governor's approach to transferring this population into Minnesota care, is that we believe the bulk of this population is more like our medical assistance disabled population than our Minnesota care working population. So we looked at this window of opportunity between now and national health care reform as an opportunity to try to use new care models that we could then expand to our disabled medical assistance population with the hope that we will have learned how to deliver more effective and efficient care at a lower price. Finally, we are also a coalition that supports revenue. We would encourage the legislature to consider within the context of this program and other state budget expenditures the need to raise greater revenues in Minnesota. Over 24 states have passed significant revenue increases last year to mitigate budget cuts and boost economic growth. We would urge Minnesota legislators to also consider real revenue increases, including requiring wealthy Minnesotans to pay their fair share in order to create a sustainable funding source for GMC and other critical state programs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Representative Blasa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Nielsen, and Ms. O'Connor, for your statements. I just thought it was really interesting on the handout that you had about who is managing the care. I think that kind of reinforces your idea that we need to be testing out new models of who do these patients relate to and trust and look to guide them through, and that the quotes are from housing case managers, one, a health care provider, a public health nurse, a psychiatric social worker, an outreach worker, a health care provider, a housing case manager, a mental health service provider, and another public health nurse. And that shows that, you know, these people are willing to reach out to and help people help them coordinate their care and help them figure out their way through the system. But they don't use the traditional doors that we've been thinking about. And I think as we move forward on this, we need to look at how can we create that medical home model or a designated provider or something so that it is someone that they trust and will actually use to do this. And much of the comments that these quotes say about why it didn't work was because so much of our case management and medical home model is based on you having a phone, you're having a normal place that someone can reach you to get mail, or whatever, and that just isn't working for this population, and I think we need to take these insights as we keep evolving the proposal. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. Mr. Tendrett. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Michael Scandrett, and I'm here with a couple hats. First hat is with the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition, and I think most people know of the coalition, but the Safety Net Coalition is those organizations whose primary mission includes serving low-income, uninsured, and disadvantaged Minnesotans. So basically the safety net providers that will serve patients even if they don't have a source of coverage or are unable to pay the cost of care. Obviously, at the GAMC cuts, our members are those who are hit hardest. What's maybe unusual about the coalition is that it spans the stakeholder groups. We have the community clinics, safety net hospitals, mental health clinics, dental clinics, programs that try to provide access for the uninsured, and other providers. So in thinking about recommendations, we're able to think about all the different parts of the system and how they fit together. But first I'm going to switch hats to the what we're calling informally the GAMC Alliance. And I think that the GAMC situation that we're in is unprecedented in terms of the potential impact, but also in terms of what it has generated on the part of the stakeholder group. And what the GAMC Alliance is virtually every group in Minnesota that chooses to participate that has an interest in trying to find a solution to the GAMC problem. So all those that have testified already and all those that are going to testify again have participated in this group. We've had a number of meetings as well as having broken down into different work groups to look at particular parts of the problem. And what I'm going to talk to you a little bit about first is that despite the differences that exist between hospitals and physicians and community clinics and others, in normal legislative sessions, we all recognize that we really need to work together in unusual ways. And so we've been meeting, trying to reach agreement as much as we can among the stakeholders so that your job will be easier, and rather than the traditional process of everybody testifying to you and then you having to meet with everybody individually and then try to figure out how to make sense of it all, or at least trying to create a way in which all the stakeholders can work through their issues and work with you more efficiently so that we can get something that can be supported by the legislature, signed by the governor, accepted by the Department of Human Services, and that the stakeholders can get behind so that something can pass in February. So there's been a lot of work going on over the past time since the legislature adjourned. And some of the principles that I'll present are the result of that work, and other people will also be presenting other results of that work. I think there's a handout, and I don't know if that's gone out yet, but I have extra copies here. You don't have enough. Let me just start with the GAMC Alliance principles. I'm just going to go through these really quickly, but again, we didn't bring the long list of organizations that are part of the Alliance, but these are as far as we could all go by the middle of November in reaching agreement on what we thought should be done about the GAMC program. First is recognizing the urgency of the problem. Most of the stakeholders feel that we do need to do something in the first weeks of session in order to put something in place that can replace what will happen without any legislative action. Having said that, though, we really appreciate what the Department of Human Services did and what the governor did with the auto enrollment. That is a really huge, important contribution to making this all go more smoothly. And we also appreciate that the commissioner and others from the department have said that if we can come up with something better before then, that they would support that. So we have that as a stopgap, and it's something that they didn't have to do. And by doing that, have created a way for us to simplify the transition process. But the Alliance believes that we need to do more than what will be done under the automatic enrollment, and that we need to try to get those things passed in law so that different programs can take place by March 1st. Just quick statement, too, believing that we probably need some temporary bridge funding. We can't solve all the permanent problems of this program and the healthcare system, so we're really looking at temporary solutions over a 16-month period, and that the solutions are needed before we'll have help from the federal government, so we need to move on those quickly. A second major area that the Alliance agreed to, I think, is a really important and, in fact, part of what the governor was trying to accomplished both in his early proposal last session and in his veto, is that the GAMC program in its current form is not sustainable and probably isn't even the best way to serve people. And so out of all the work that the stakeholders have done over the past few months, we've reached the conclusion that we do need a major change in the program, and that under that major change, we should be able to provide the care people need at a much lower cost than has been provided in the past. And so acknowledging that, we're now looking at what, not trying to restore the program, but what we can do to create something different, more efficient, less expensive than in the past. Also in bringing together the stakeholders and as they were working on different pieces of it, what we've learned is that the GAMC population is not all of a particular type. There are subgroups, and this was discussed a little bit earlier today, that there are different groups of people within GAMC. So as you all look at the different proposals and think about solutions, I hope you'll keep in mind these different categories, because I think a different solution is appropriate for each. One is that person that has a sudden illness or injury that's uninsured, ends up in the hospital at a very significant expense. The hospital has no one to bill for that service. It's not something that we really need to improve the care management system for. It really is about the funding and the cost to the safety net providers and the hospitals of serving uninsured people. And for this, we need to kind of look at more of a funding strategy for making sure that no particular providers or hospitals are bearing an unfair share of the burden of dealing with those uninsured people. A second category is the homeless, and as people mentioned before, the homeless may not be able to navigate the traditional Minnesota care program and application process. They may not also be well served by our traditional approaches to providing medical care, where we expect people to make appointments and go to the clinic. So we also need another approach for that group. A third category is those people who most often have both mental illness and chemical dependency, and often other medical conditions as well, who are the frequent utilizers of the system. And this is where we do need a completely different way to think about serving the population. And that's all the things we've talked about here and that you've talked about and even have supported in the past about paying people differently,
creating different incentives of the system, coordinating care, and thinking outside the traditional healthcare silo to look at housing, social services, and other services as being part of the package of things we need to do to keep people healthy. Another category is those people who are probably eligible for SSI and medical assistance because of a disability, and that there's been a lot of work, and I think more information will be coming to you later about better ways that we can get people on those programs as quickly as possible so that there's a federal share in the costs rather than it all being a state cost. And then the final category is just the extremely poor people who maybe they can navigate the Minnesota care application process, maybe they can enroll in a managed care plan, but they simply don't have even enough money to pay the Minnesota care premium or the co-pays, and without some assistance in that area, they're not going to be able to make it through and have the coverage. So these are the categories of people, and I appreciate some of the discussion earlier about maybe not talking about programs as much as talking about the services people need, and it maybe doesn't matter whether it's Minnesota Care or GAMC. We should be looking at what people need and how what's the fairest way of providing the funding that's needed to support the needs that they have rather than deciding if it's appropriately in the general assistance medical care or Minnesota Care program. A third area of agreement among the alliance is on improving the eligibility application and enrollment process. Simplify programs, make them easier to use so that they're easier to understand as well, and not have the churn that results as people are going in and out of coverage that will, in a way that will affect continuity of care if people are receiving treatment. The final area of the alliance agreement is around the financing, and the majority of the stakeholders, and nearly all of the stakeholders, would agree that the Healthcare Access Fund is an appropriate place to look for funding for the program, and but also agreed that the Minnesota Care Program is not appropriate for some people. It is an acceptable program for some, but not all of the people in the program. So that's just a little bit about the common principles of the alliance. Now I'm going to turn more to the Safety Net Coalition proposal. As we developed our proposal, I think a very important thing to consider in looking at the solutions is really broadening the view to see who is really paying for the services under the current system and under the proposals that are out there. Because when the state stops paying for general assistance medical care, doesn't mean that the costs are going away, and in fact for the people that are in the Safety Net Coalition, they're going to continue to serve the patient regardless of whether that source of payment is there until they're unable to do so because they're no longer financially viable. And so when the state doesn't pay, the cost then is either shifted to the providers or often to local governments. And when it's shifted to providers have to increase their payment rates that they charge to insurance companies and employers and private paying people. So if you look at the broader picture, if these costs are going to be incurred anyway, it's everybody that's going to pay in various ways through higher health care costs, through higher local property taxes, through expenses that end up in the criminal justice or public safety systems. So if we take that point of view, then I think it's a little easier to look at what the appropriate financing sources are for that. And probably worth revisiting just briefly what the origins of both the Medicaid surcharge and the provider tax that were really many years ago developed to recognize the fact that healthcare providers, if they don't have coverage for a patient, they're going to end up incurring a loss for that patient later on. And that not just incurring that cost, but in the worst possible way, because people won't be getting preventive care, they'll delay care, they'll not go to outpatient services, they'll end up in the emergency room in crisis situations. So the cost ends up being more for the providers and the hospitals if there's not a source of coverage. So both the Medicaid surcharge and the provider taxes were intended for a way that the providers who will benefit from these programs can provide funding so that that coverage can be provided in a way that's more efficient and appropriate. And so it's not like your typical tax in that it's not a way of taxing a broad base of people in order to support a good that benefits a particular part of the population. It is actually a way of raising money from those who are the beneficiaries of the program to provide the funding more upfront when people need the care and through a mechanism of coverage rather than later where they will have to absorb the losses because the patient does not have any health coverage. So given that perspective, we again think that the Health Care Access Fund is an appropriate source of funding. We think the Medicaid surcharge is also an appropriate source of funding and also would have the benefit of drawing down federal reimbursement, a federal match that allows us to do more with fewer state dollars. The bottom line on our position on funding is that the providers and the counties and government are going to pay one way or the other. And so we want to look at what's the financing method that we can pay, keep the cost down, pay in the appropriate way, and pay in a way that's fair to both the providers and to local government. Second, I want to move on to the accountable care organizations concept, and this is something that the Safety Net Coalition strongly supports for a couple of reasons. One is that when you have a lot of patients who don't have any insurance, you're probably among the most highly motivated providers to try to control the cost of health care than anybody else. And so the safety net providers have actually developed accountable care organization type activities, ways to work with people in the community, keep them as healthy as possible, try to use the less expensive of different ways of treating people, the less expensive drugs can you do that are available to treat the condition, all to keep that cost down, both for their avoiding the losses that the safety net providers will have, but also avoiding the cost to the individuals who are also paying towards the cost of care. So we think these things work very well to reduce total cost. They work very well to improve health and improve the quality of care that's provided. And one of the main barriers to controlling costs and improving the healthcare system is really how healthcare services are paid for. And so even though we can't get the payoff fast enough to fix GAMC in the next couple of months or years, in the long term, this is maybe the most important thing that we can do, because in the long term, this is the way we're going to be able to keep healthcare costs in the future down by having incentives that prevent the kind of escalating costs that occur now when providers in the system are rewarded for doing as much as possible, providing the most expensive services, and not doing anything really to keep the patients healthy. We have had a chance to look at the DFL proposal. I'm not going to go through in detail our response to that. Really appreciated hearing about Representative Dean's proposal too, and liked a lot about that. And so after hearing other people today and the discussion today as well, I'm actually encouraged, because I'm not hearing areas where there's strong disagreement. I'm hearing a lot of recognition, one, that these are the poorest and neediest citizens, and there's less debate about whether the government has a role in serving them. But secondly, the consequences of ending the program completely would not be something that we would all want to see happen, and that we need to reform the program to both make it better and to reduce costs. That seems to be a very common theme, regardless of your political views and your perspectives as a stakeholder. So I think I'm just going to stop there with that basic. We, again, have a lot of detail we can provide in other settings on these various areas. So I just wanted to get the high-level concepts that we're recommending, and then to let you know that both the Alliance and the Coalition are available to work with you to get us close as we can to an agreement that we can be broadly supported and be passed as quickly as possible at the beginning of session. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you for all your work on this.
Thank you.
And the whole coalition. Ms. Krinke. So how does the MA surcharge work?
The good, the bad, the ugly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I first would like to start out and say thank you to each of you. This has been a long day, and I really, and on behalf of all of our hospitals, appreciate how much time and attention you have given to this issue throughout the summer and fall. I know a number of you have done hospital visits, you've done hospital tours, you've held work groups, so first and foremost, thank you very much. Second of all, I'd like to say we appreciate how much urgency this issue has been given, and I've heard a number of people testify today, and I've heard Chairman Huntley's comments that it is the goal to pass something quickly in the legislative session, and thank you very much for that as well. Over the summer and fall, the Minnesota Hospital Association convened a work group, and we looked at this issue, and one of the things that we discovered was that there really weren't any great solutions to this problem. All of the solutions that we looked at were somewhat controversial and did regard pain to all of those involved. So the Hospital Association has identified what we're calling five buckets, and we believe the solution, the best solution, is probably to choose a combination of those buckets. And each of these is controversial. So number one is some use of the Healthcare Access Fund on a temporary basis. We recognize that that depletes a shrinking pot of money. But nonetheless, we do think it is appropriate to use money out of the Healthcare Access Fund. Number two, and this is the only time you will ever hear anybody from the Hospital Association say this, and that is that we are willing to accept provider payment cuts in the GAMC program as part of the solution. Please know that that does come with some pain amongst our members, and so that statement will never be repeated again. But for the record, we are willing to accept provider payment cuts, and I have a plan today to share with you all regarding that. Number three is a recognition that the counties do have a role in the solution to this problem. If you look at the vulnerable adult law as well as how GAMC is organized through the counties, we believe that the counties do have a share of this solution. Number four is program redesign that will bring about cost savings. And number five, obviously controversial, new revenues need to be part of the solution. So those are the five areas that the Hospital Association has identified, and we believe that the combination is the best. I would like to specifically address three things that we have talked about today. The first of which is the GAMC provider payments. Second is the accountable care organization. And third is the hospital surcharge. Regarding the GAMC provider payments, what we did was we looked at all hospital GAMC revenues and divided our membership up into two buckets. If you had more than 1% net patient revenues, we were suggesting a 25% payment cut. And if you had net patient revenues of less than 1% in the GAMC program, we were suggesting a 50% payment cut. All other healthcare providers would receive a 25% payment reduction. The combination of those three items raises $104 million over the 16-month period. I realize that this is a little different than what is in the DFL proposal that was announced Thursday. I would like to specifically thank Representative Murphy. Thank Representative Murphy for her amendment. It does address one of the issues that was of grave concern to us, and I'd like to just explain a little bit about how that threshold provision that was in her original bill was going to work. And I'd like to use as an example Detroit Lakes Hospital, St. Mary's Hospital, Detroit Lakes. They have about $900,000 worth of GAMC services that they provide. Under a 50% rate cut, that would be $450,000 worth of payments. With a $500,000 threshold, that hospital would receive zero GAMC payments, despite the fact that they have above 2% of their net patient revenue is in the GAMC program. So we really think that a threshold really hurts our smaller hospitals that, despite their size, have a fair amount of GAMC business. So we think a percentage payment cut is by far a fairer way to look at this issue rather than having any threshold that you have to meet first. So while I haven't really analyzed or run the numbers on Representative Murphy's amendment, I think it's a step in the right direction. The next issue I just want to mention quickly is the accountable care organizations. The Hospital Association has not taken an official position on whether or not we think an ACO would work for this population. We have a number of our members who are looking at reform and payment reform and looking at total cost of care management. The question is, do we think it works very well for this population? I'm sure in, over the next few weeks here we will be taking a position, but I would like to point out, regardless, we need to have a fee-for-service model for emergency room payment. A hospital cannot help who shows up at their door, and under EMTALA, we cannot send somebody to another hospital and say, oh, by the way, we can't provide services to you. Please go to Hennepin County Medical Center because they're your accountable care organization. So we need to make sure that as we move forward with reform, that emergency room services are still on a fee-for-service basis, even if it's at 50% payment. Okay, so we just need to make sure we pull that part out of an ACO. And the last issue that I'd like to just quickly talk about is the hospital surcharge issue. And I know this is an issue that we're going to look at over the next few weeks here, but let me just quickly explain. Right now, hospitals pay a 1.56% hospital surcharge on all revenue excluding Medicare. So right now, it is on all other hospital revenue minus Medicare. There has been some discussion about that 5% limit, and I will be honest with you, the last we have heard or checked, we believe that CMS has raised that limit up to 5.5, and I am not sure how the provider tax is calculated, because CMS only cares about what you are trying to get matched, okay? So while we don't want more hospital fees, CMS cares about what you are trying to get matched. Some of the provider tax is matched and some of the provider tax is not matched. So this is going to take some number crunching from the department so that we can figure out how much room is there in the surcharge. Now, that being said, I don't know that we love all of it, but we are somewhat looking at this surcharge as well because it is one of the few mechanisms that brings in federal matching dollars. So as we try to come up with new funding for the GAMC program, the surcharge does allow us to leverage federal dollars back to Minnesota. So the only other comment that I would like to make is that it is redistributive. So it's not a perfect match. All hospitals will not be held harmless, okay? It is a question that the money has to go back into the Medicaid program. That's how you double the money. So the more Medicaid business you have, the more harmless you are held. And the less Medicaid business you have, the more you are paying in. So I don't want to leave the impression today that this is a perfect solution. We recognize that it might be part of the final legislative fix for a 16-month period. And the only other comment that I would like to make is, while we are very grateful for all the work that has been done to date, it does look like to us the provider community is being asked pretty heavily here to be the lion's share of the solution. And we firmly believe that this needs to be a shared pain, shared responsibility solution. So thank you.
Thank you. And so just to clarify to Representative Broad's question, it's actually on private pay as well as Medicaid, except for Medicare.
Yes, it is on all revenue to the hospital minus Medicare.
Right. Okay.
And if I could, I'm sorry, one of the holes that is in the bill is there's a corresponding Medicaid increase, and obviously, as we try to run these numbers for the hospital association and for our members, it's not just a question of what is being paid out in the Medicaid surcharge, it's what are you going to get back in with the corresponding Medicaid increase. So we have to look at those two numbers in conjunction with each other.
No, and that's a very good point. And I would note, I think we didn't go through all the funding sources in the bill, but there is a different surcharge on HMOs as well. Just so, and I'm sure you're aware of that, but just so people are clear.
That's part of the shared pain, shared responsibility approach.
I'm just saying, yes. Thank you. Yes, thank you very much. Any questions? Before Ms. Krinke? Okay, thank you. Mr. Carlson. And we have a handout that's coming around. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I recognize you've been here a long time, and I will try and be as brief as I can. I am Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association, whose membership consists of the 5 collar counties here in the metro area and the 8 of the 9 larger counties in greater Minnesota. I want to start out by basically acknowledging the efforts of the administration, the efforts of the majority members of this committee, particularly Representative Murphy, and also Representative Dean in putting together solutions to this challenging issue that's before us as a result of the financial problems being suffered by the state. I'm sorry, I really haven't had a lot of opportunities to look at Representative Dean's proposal, so the rest of my comments are primarily going to be confined to the administration proposal and the...
Can I just... go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
Sure. I do want to particularly say that the proposal that's been put forth by Representative Murphy and the other leadership of the committee is superior to the governor's proposed solution of enrolling everybody in transitional MnCare. One, it provides immediate retroactive coverage, reducing the disproportionate burdens placed on major medical facilities. And two, it eliminates premiums for the homeless and chemically dependent, and possibly the discontinuity of coverage because of lack of resources to pay those premiums. We think this is particularly important to maintain services to the mentally ill, the chemically dependent, and other chronically ill individuals. One thing that hasn't been mentioned but I think needs to be recognized is Representative Murphy's bill's effort to address mental health urgent care. We think this is a critical need, that the burden lies way too much on particularly Regents and HCMC right now. The one major issue that counties have with this bill is the 10% county share. First, to acquaint you with the status of current law, there's a moratorium until July 1st of 2011 on new maintenance of effort or cost shares on counties. You would have to amend that law in order to impose this. Secondly, there's a practical issue. The first 10 months of the 16-month period that you're trying to cover by really explicitly raising property taxes, it's too late for us to as counties to do that. Our levies for calendar year 2010 were effectively set back in September 15th. We cannot raise our levies beyond the preliminary levy that we certified back then, nor can we raise them beyond the final levies that have either been certified or are in the process of being certified these next 2 weeks. Instead, other programs and staff will have to be cut to accommodate the this year's or 2010's portion of the $29 million that was assumed to be paid by counties. 2011, yeah, there is possibility that we could levy property taxes to do that, but we still have to do that with inside levy limits, and levy limits are extremely tight. For 2010, the inflationary increase we got was 0.68%. If that same indice was used to set our inflation adjustment for 2011 right now, at best it would be a 0% increase, because that indice right now, third quarter to third quarter, is negative, not positive. Hopefully that will change slightly, but an increase of more than 1% for inflation is unlikely. We'd like to suggest to you again, if a property tax increase is your specific intent for funding some of the costs, that the legislature has the wherewithal to levy that tax directly. You already levy a property tax on commercial industrial properties and seasonal recreational properties implicitly to fund education. We suggest to you that you can appropriately also do that to at least provide for the transitional costs of GAMC. It's been suggested here that this is just going back to the way things were back in 1991, and I'll have to correct you that going back to the way it was in 1991 would call for you to restore the dollar-for-dollar offset that we suffered in what at the time was called Homestead and Agricultural Credit Aid to get us back to where we were at. If you want to restore the money that we lost, then maybe it's a different conversation, but getting us back to where we were calls for two actions. One, reinstating the county share, and two, reinstating the money that we used to receive that was taken away when we made this exchange. We've also suggested to alternately to provide some room for us to do this is to provide us some relief for the over $230 million of maintenance of effort requirements that are placed on us. You worked to provide us some relief from these during the last session, but unfortunately I have to report to you our maintenance of effort requirements have gone up, not down, from 2009 to 2010. I'll just go on to a final couple additional concerns with the bill. One is that there's been mentioned that, well, the counties will have to pay this 10%, but it's avoiding some cost here. In fact, the bill does not help us avoid some of those costs. The coverage for GAMC recipients who are jailed is taken away from the bill. We will have to pay those costs instead of the state paying those costs, as is true under current law. It's also true for those in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. The counties pay 10% of the cost of individuals who are confined at Moose Lake or St. Peter right now from that program. That's about $13,500 a year. With the fact that GAMC will no longer provide medical coverage for those individuals, counties will share in those costs. We also have some concerns with the accountable care organization provision. At a very minimum, what would be required for any county to consider this is something to indemnify us in case costs go beyond, substantially beyond the funding that's provided on this capitated basis. Right now, we read it that we're the guarantor of last resort and have the consequence would be very hesitant to engage in this option. Secondly, the Accountable Care Organization, as has already been referenced by Representative Liebling, seems very much like the county-based purchasing that exists within South Country, within Prime West, within Itasca County currently, yet the bill suspends those organizations from providing GAMC coverage right now.
That's not the intent.
Okay.
And so, and I don't know where your language is. If you could point out to Representative Murphy where you think that it reads that way, let us know, because the intent is actually to allow county-based purchasing organizations to do that.
Okay. I will touch base with the representative later. We have similar concerns with regards to the PMAP. Again, it appears to us that PMAPs will no longer provide care for that portion of the GAMC population that is currently receiving care on that basis rather than a fee-for-service basis. This may save money by going to a fee-for-service basis only for providing care for these individuals during the 16-month horizon that's covered, but we have to express some concern about the discontinuity of coverage that will occur for these individuals, particularly those who basically are looking for this for ongoing health care, not an incident-by-incident type basis. With that, I'll conclude. I'll just mention the last two pages does have a breakdown of the approximate property tax impact by county. These are rough estimates based on 2008 GAMC expenditures, but you can get some idea what your individual counties that you represent are facing.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Questions? Thanks a lot.
Appreciate you.
It. That's helpful. Mr. Vincent, Mr. Melton, if you want to come on down too. Welcome to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here, Mr. Chairman. I am Steve Vincent. I'm a psychologist from St. Cloud, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Psychological Association. As a benefit of coming at the end of the day, I've had a chance to hear several compelling statements about the need to maintain coverage for the JAMC population, and also many thoughtful ideas about how to do this. So as a result, I'm sure you'll be happy to know I can be brief and avoid repetition. For those of you who've testified before me today, thank you for many thoughtful and caring statements. I'm humbled by the commitment and the care that people have shown today. Speaking for psychologists, and I think for other mental health professionals as well, I simply want to say it's essential to note that the lack of payment for care not only raises the chance that people will not get care, it really raises the chance that more people will need more care, because poverty and its associated stresses are known causes of mental health and substance abuse problems, and of general health problems as well. So we need to keep in mind the principle, first, do no harm. And we're called to avoid the harm of cutting access to care by cutting payment for care. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Melson.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, I'm very glad to be here today. My name is Bob Nelson. I'm the Chair of Public Policy for the March Association, Minnesota Association for Resources, Recovering Chemical Health, about 1,000 counselors and programs across the state. And I, too, can be very brief. Basically, what I'd like to say is thank you to the committee very much for taking this challenge on. It's a really important issue. March sees ourselves as advocates for most of our clients. We've met with Representative Murphy and shared our specific concerns. Many of our clients do qualify for GAMC, and while they're in treatment, they receive supportive services like psychotropic medication, which makes it pretty difficult to do treatment with somebody when they're having a psychotic episode. So maintaining those kind of care. Another thing that leads to relapse is not feeling good, which means if you can't have access to medical care, you're much more likely to try to find a way to take away not feeling good. And the people that I work with have found out that drugs and alcohol work. Only question I have is there's a statement in there which I think is very clarifying and helpful about not using GAMC funds to pay for treatment programs that are referenced in 254 A and B, which are chemical dependency. My only concern would be if somebody misread that and said that the managed care or prepaid medical plans did not have to use GAMC money to pay for treatment programs, thereby putting all of the weight back on the CCDGF. That's just an unintended consequence that occurred to me in a paranoid fantasy life when I was sitting here listening to everybody. I'm sure it's not accurate. But that's really about it. I really want to thank you guys for taking this on. And while I'm sure you're marginally enthused, I'm enthused to hear that people are actually working together here on something positive, both sides of the aisle and the department. It's important, and I think it's really important you keep it working that way.
Thank you very much. And Reverend Murphy, you understand what he was talking about? Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Thank you.
Thank you again for allowing me to be here.
Yes. Well, and thank you all of you for all your patience today, working through this. You know, the one group that we still need to engage and didn't come and talk to us, I think, is the business community, which is going to have a huge impact if this isn't fixed. And so I would encourage the chamber and all those other folks to get on board with trying to come up with a solution as well, because it's going to hurt business as well. So thank you all for all your work on this, and everybody in the audience, because this is a great thing. And Representative Huntley, before we adjourn.
Yeah, I'd like to thank everybody that's come and testified, and I'd like to especially
recognize Representative Murphy for all the work that she has done on this. You know, it's nice to have a committee with good people on it because you can just tell them to do something and it gets done. I think the whole focus here was not on the hospital-only people. What we were looking at is ways to manage people that have chronic illnesses. And if there's ever a group of people where the counties and the healthcare system have to work together, it's this particular group. And so we hope they get together and help us solve this problem. So thank you for coming.
Thank you, and we are adjourned.